From the racetracks around Australia, here's Inside Motorsport.
I'm feeling a bit hungry myself at this time of day. It is Christmas Eve 2000, and Merry Christmas to you and all your family there. If you're enjoying a barbecue or a cold drink at the moment, I'm sure we will be too. But on the other side of the panel, the men who have been here all this year, and that, of course, is Peter Norton and Colin Ford. Good evening, fellas.
Good evening, Craig.
I don't think setting up the barbecue in the back of the studio was the best idea for our Christmas barbecue.
I think the smoke is getting a bit too much, Craig. We'll have to do something about this before the smoke alarm goes off.
That is the truth. But an interesting show for everyone. A bit of Christmas fare on the Inside Motorsport table tonight with Phil Brannigan going to be along. We'll have a look. Peter, you've been working hard looking back at the carp season. We'll also have a look at Murray Walker's departure. Unfortunately, the death of Stan Fox in New Zealand early in the week is a tragic story to relate to you, considering the accident that he survived at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in, I think it was 1995, to then be killed on the road in New Zealand is a great tragedy. And I had an opportunity to speak to Robin Miller from the Indianapolis Star newspaper about that and a whole bunch more. In fact, Indianapolis is known as being the home of motorsport, the world capital of motorsport, and the three events that they have on there, you'd be hard-pressed to find three bigger events happening in the one city. Adelaide might try to rival it, but they still can't match a NASCAR race, the Indianapolis 500 and the Formula One race, I don't think. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a city. Can you think of a city that holds three as big events?
I really can't. It really is the golden three of motorsport around the world.
Colin?
I suppose if Adelaide got the Formula One Grand Prix back from Melbourne, then, of course, with the Clipsal 500, the American Le Mans sports car series race and the Formula One race, and I'm sure that... Oh, plus then you've got the classic Adelaide rally for historic sports cars. I think we could come pretty close, but I think it'd be just that whisker of just something about Indianapolis.
Yeah, I think they might have the wood on us there. But we chat to Robin Miller about Stan Fox and the Indianapolis motor racing legacy. We also have that promised interview with Smokey Unick, a real character in American motorsport. We'll have an opportunity to hear from another character in motorsport from a slightly different generation in Ned Jarrett. Scott Pruitt will be along to have a chat about his experiences as a NASCAR kart and all-round good guy. And a whole bunch more. So it should be a very interesting show. But fellas, what have you seen over the week that has caught your eye?
Well, I'd say in my eye, it's the fact that one of the things we'll discuss a little bit later with Phil Brannigan is, of course, Mark Larkin might attend the sponsorship deal there after 10 years splitting up. Basically, might have decided it's time to change direction in terms of their marketing. They're happy with what they've got out of Mark. But if you look at it, it's the time where he's finally reached what you'd say is ready to break into the big time, and a large part of the financial rug's just been pulled out from under him, but hopefully things can go better for him there.
My highlight during the week was getting the second issue of V8X. We spoke about it last week as a bit of a preview, and finally taking delivery of it during the week, I found it to be quite spectacular. It was a very good issue.
And an interesting story there with Craig Lowndes. Quite interesting to see that I don't think Craig Lowndes even knows what he's doing next year.
Yeah, I get that impression as well. They really don't know. And really the question is, could he potentially sit the year out waiting for something to really come together?
Now, money, motorsport and governments. Peter, you were talking off air. Perhaps we need to mention that on air, that perhaps as a taxpayer you wouldn't like to see your money going to Bathurst?
No, I was there in the mud and the slop and the rain, and of course it was miserable, and we'd love to see better facilities. But Avesco, suggesting that the taxpayer needs to foot the bill for some of their elaborate plans there, I'm a little bit disappointed in that the place only gets used once a year, so why should we build the Taj Mahal of motorsport there for one event, in particular for potentially the richest series in Australia? I think the taxpayers' monies would be much better spent on a more general purpose facility that can get used every week of the year.
Colin?
Yeah, well, I think essentially if they are going to try and, you know, upgrade Bathurst, they're looking for millions of dollars of government and taxpayers' money. If it's only going to be used once a year for the V8 supercar race, the October long weekend, well, then I would see that as being a bad investment as a taxpayer. I would see it as being, if the plan is, though, to improve the facilities and therefore potentially attract other motorsport events so it does get used on a more regular basis and therefore has potential spin-off effects for the local economy and for Australia as a whole by attracting other series. You might think, okay, there's a chance there for some money, but not the huge amounts we're talking. I'm probably one of those people who would rather see money put into race circuits that can be used 364 days of the year for driver training, for race meetings, for testing by teams, that can get you can get your full use for your dollar that you invest into it, rather than pour all the money in and then all you do is get 7 days a year use out of the facility.
Mm. All right. Well, it has been an interesting proposal that has been mooted in, of course, Motorsport News. And, of course, the plans for the new pit facility and grandstands there, well, are quite interesting. Myself, I don't particularly like the look of it or the layout of it, but each to their own. After the break, though, we will come back with Phil Brennigan from Motorsport News, and I'm sure he's got a lot more to say about the current edition of Motorsport News out as we speak.
Inside Motorsport will return after these messages.
Inside Motorsport, brought to you today by Summernex 2001, the biggest and best car show in Australia. The Summernex Car Festival is on again from January 4th to 7th. There'll be your old favourites, including the Burnout Comp, Horsepower Hero Dino Test, Elite and Street Judging, plus fireworks, super cruisers, live music and rides for the kids. Don't miss seeing Peter Brock. He'll be signing autographs on the Mobile One stand. Summernex 2001, Thursday the 4th of January till Sunday the 7th. It's the biggest and best car show in Australia, sponsors of Triple S.
I really don't want to talk about this. No one's asked me to our formal, and I was late for history, and so at lunchtime I had to find something on Alfred Deakin, so I had to call Mum, and she found something on the internet for me, but Dad helped me conjugate the verbs or whatever on the way to swimming, and then he was reading that history paper while I was in the pool, and of course I forgot the bibliography, so I had to do that with Mum when I got home. Anyway, I'm not even going to the formal. I just want to stay home with Mum and Dad.
Family.
And just hang out.
Isn't it about time?
Unless Jason asks me.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Inside Motorsport, from the racetrack to your radio.
And in the lead-up to Christmas, of course, you're always looking for some good reading to keep you going during the lean hours when there's nothing on television and you're sitting back on the beach, kicking back and watching the children play with their new Christmas presents. Of course, what's the best way to go? With the latest issue of Motorsport News, Phil Brennigan, you've got the latest issue out, which covers the 22nd of December through the 4th of January, the Christmas edition with the Santa hat on top of the tee on Motorsport News. And, of course, you've scooped the pool a bit with the guys with the new plans for Bathurst. You've been able to sneak them out of the Avesco vault.
Yes, there was a bit of skullduggery going on there on the side, but Avesco's got big plans for Bathurst. Tony Cochran, who, let's not forget, is the man who said that there are no sacred sites to motor racing when he appeared. Of course, one nice thing about Tony Cochran is he admits when he's wrong. He said, I'm wrong in this case. Bathurst is an icon. We want to see it restored to its former glory, and we want to see it become the world's best racetrack. And he's met with the Bathurst City Council. They are actively seeking government involvement now to turn Bathurst into the best racetrack in the business. And we show you the plans for the grandstand, and it's actually going to be on the opposite side of the track to where the pits are at the moment.
Mm. I hope somewhere in those plans got an idea to do some sealing of the area behind the old pits at least as well.
Well, one thing I mentioned to Tony, half jokingly, is when I saw the plans, is where's the new media centre, and he said one of the priorities now is to make sure that the motor racing is more media friendly, because he realises, as we all do in the last 2 weeks, as if we need reminding after $400 million for rugby league and $500 million for AFL, that sport needs the media and media needs the sport. So there will be revised camping facilities, better spectator facilities, better corporate facilities. And there's a number of stages involved in the project, and hopefully there'll be better facilities for most people involved in 2002 and a brand new pit complex in 2003.
Mm. And of course that'll just make it so much easier for the teams who are competing at Bathurst, because one of the big problems has been in the past, you've got the headlining guys and then you've got the support guys,
having two pit lanes effectively now, one inside the circuit, one outside, means that the support guys, they can work on the inside, the major teams, they can work on the outside, and there's no problems getting cars in or bits and pieces out during the race.
Absolutely true. Behind the new pit complex, there will be room for Pantex. There currently isn't that. There's a whole hodgepodge of buildings at the back of the paddock, if you've never been to Bathurst. There's sheds and shacks and concrete pads with nothing on them that magically gain marquees. And this way, everyone will have the same situation. The support events at Bathurst, I guess, in the main show, is less important. Of course, they're important to the support teams. But there's been a revolution in the last 2 years. Look what Prancing Horse is doing now in Nations Cup. I mean, there are support event teams arriving with V8 supercar size setups, so they have to be accommodated somewhere.
And that's the thing, that realistically, if you look at it as it was for Bathurst this year with the rain, with those guys in marquees in what essentially was a very large mud pit, they really do need something that is better.
I don't know, if it rains and you're up to your knees in mud, I don't think it's a marquee, it's a tent.
It starts off being called a marquee, then it becomes just this dripping piece of canvas.
That's the one.
Now, the other story, of course, which is fairly big this week, is the fact that Mark Lycombe, he, of course, has lost his Mitre 10 sponsorship. He retains a couple of his sponsors, but no doubt there'll be a mad and a fairly hectic search to get enough, to get some sponsors in to at least top up the coffers a bit.
Yeah, absolutely true. Mark has put a very positive spin on the whole situation, as he does. He said that he never really expected to be sponsored by Mitre 10 for the rest of his life. It's actually the second longest standing sponsorship deal in Australian motor racing behind Shell sponsorship of both Dick Johnson Racing and the series, so I guess that makes like a third. That goes all the way back to Formula Holden, and it's been a decade. And Mitre 10 are changing directions, of course. They've got a much stronger marketplace now, or stronger opposition with people like Bunnings and the big warehouse barns. So Mitre 10 are moving on. It's a little ironic that they stick with him through all the lean times. Lyco looks like he's going to have some success now, and Mitre 10 disappear, but hey, it's their decision, it's their choice, it's a free country. And Lyco saying, we've got a lot to offer a new sponsor, and he does. He's got show cars, and he works very hard for his sponsors off the track. And the MTech team's been getting very competitive. So I guess we'll see a situation sometime in the future where there'll be two cars coming out of Lyco's stable, but certainly for next year, regardless of whether there's Mitre 10 or anybody else involved, we'll see Karcher and Ford supporting Lycombe, and he'll continue to one-run car in the SCS.
And of course, the other story that you covered in this last issue is, not the feeling, the Toyota V8 program very likely, unlikely, with the move of one of the key people over there.
True, there's been talk on and off the last few years, and we've been involved in this motorsport news, that Toyota are going to come in, that Mitsubishi might come in. Of course, Tom Phillips, formerly of Toyota Australia, is now running Mitsubishi. He was a marketing man at Toyota before he moved across. There's been talk that your Neil Bates was going to be involved somewhere along the line, and there was going to be a couple of V8 Avalons, perhaps driven by Les Patterson and Dame Ender Everidge on the grid at Bathurst 1 year. It looks unlikely that's going to happen now, because the prime mover, Peter Evans, has moved on to Hyundai. Now, I don't know whether that means we're going to see a Hyundai V8 supercar, but certainly I would say there's less chance of Toyota going V8 supercar racing now than there has been in the past, and I never really thought there was going to be a lot of opportunity for them in the past, so it must be down near zero now.
And of course, the interesting part is that Hyundai, they've moved in quite nicely into world rallying with the Hyundai Accent, which is a car that they're actually making quite a big marketing push with currently, so the potential there is, if they really want to widen up the Australian Rally Championship between the top guys, Subaru, Possum Bourne, and the Corolla of Neil Bates, the opportunity is there with somebody to step in with, say, a year-old Hyundai Accent WRC and add a third player to the competition.
I would say you're right. I'd say that's quite possible, because not only now with Peter Evans moving across from Toyota to Hyundai, the public relations man at Hyundai Australia is former Ford man Richard Power, who's got a long history and involvement in motorsport at Ford. So I would say that with them pushing the Accent very hard, and let's not forget the Accent's just one best small car in various RAC and NRMA magazines around the country, and not best value, best small car. So now Hyundai are starting to sell their cars on the merits of their engineering and how nice they are to drive. And that's what Subaru were doing 8 or 9 years ago. So I can see Hyundai following in the footsteps. And I think you're right. I wouldn't be surprised if maybe not 2002, but maybe not 2001, but 2002, we may see Hyundai go into the Australian Rally Championship. Wouldn't that be great?
Well, even if this coming season it's a case of they put the toe in the water with a few people supporting a couple of older S-Coupe rally cars around the place or similar, and it could actually work out quite well for them to get a fair bit of exposure.
Yeah, I mean, the rallying in this country is heading in the right direction. More professionalism, Toyota still involved, Subaru, of course, now involved with the Rally of Canberra, which is good news. Not an ARC event, but a high-profile event in the Asia-Pacific. Caltech's Havilland starting to spend some money. The tyre manufacturers are still supporting the class well. And Arcon moving ahead. So with the continued growth of the TV package, I think rallying is going to be big business in this country. And if they can get in early, I think it's going to be a good thing for Hyundai or any other manufacturer.
And of course, the big story that's coming up in terms of the fact that we aren't going to suffer a complete lack of motorsport over the Christmas New Year break, because on New Year's Eve we have the Race of 1,000 Years down in Adelaide, and of course the latest news there is that Murphy and Bright are teaming up with David Brabham in his Pinot, in one of the Pinot's cars, to compete in that event.
Yes, they are. David Brabham, of course, a guy with a wealth of experience, and he needs no introduction from somebody like me. So I actually had lunch with Greg Murphy last week, and he said that he expects David to qualify the car right at the sharp end of the field. David feels that the car will be well suited to the Adelaide track, as opposed to the Audis having an advantage on some of the sweeping circuits they've been to. So with David's pace, the proven reliability of the Panos around the streets, and let's not forget the Adelaide Grand Prix was always a race of attrition. You always saw some fairly tired looking racing cars at the end of the race, and you always got some knackered looking drivers. So I think having three drivers is a great idea. I think Bridie and Murph will back up Brabham very well. They're doing 50-minute stints, and Panels have got a good team, so there's a good chance that I'll be in the top three by the end of the night.
And the thing is, too, in the case of both Greg Murphy and Jason Bright, they've both come off in an endurance race at Bathurst, where they have got the mindset in place for that type of event.
And really, they're both ideally placed, because they've both got recent experience in open wheelers, not just a V8 supercar. So the power's not going to overwhelm them, because they're used to 600 horsepower in a supercar. And they're used to going through what is compared to a Panos, a pig of a race car. But they're also used to the refinements of open wheelers. And Murph and Brady both said the same thing. It feels like it's an open wheeler to drive with a lot more weight and a lot more grunt. So good for them. I think Don Panos bringing the race here is a bold move. I don't think sports car racing has got a great profile in this country, but we're not going to get one if we don't have any races. And I think Uncle Don's done us all a favour.
Of course, as usual, you've got your sort of great... This issue, I found, has got the great trivia quiz. And I sat down when I picked up the magazine yesterday and I started reading through thinking, they've definitely been delving into the history books and the statistics books and you name it to come up with those questions, but we don't get the answers until the next issue.
Well, I didn't want people to welch out. A few people in the office said to me, I'll put the answers on page 59 or something like that. I went, no, you've got to have people thinking about this while they're having their turkey. Half those questions actually came off the top of the heads of people, like I said in the intro. We were just playing smart aleck games in the office. And the other half took some research. We've since found out there's a mistake in one of the questions. I'm sorry. We'll clarify that. We'll accept the best three answers, and there's actually the best four answers. And there are some we thought of we should have included. There are some people have contacted us and said they're too hard. Someone else rang us and said they're too easy. I don't know. We're in the business. I hope people enjoy it. If it's successful and if people like it, we'll do it every year. We'll keep on coming up with new questions. And, of course, maybe we'll put the trivia quiz in the almanac in the same issue one day.
And, of course, the other thing you've included in this last issue is the season review for the V8 supercars, which is probably a very good way to wrap up everything that's taken place in what has been a fairly hectic season.
It has been a very hectic season. And as I say in the review, there hasn't been a lot of talk about parity, so there's been a lot going on behind the scenes. And people like you and I have been digging away and driving people and racing drivers crazy, trying to find out what's been happening away from the tracks. But the racing's been terrific. We've had lots of different winners. A little bit of a downturn as far as Ingall was concerned, as far as his championship aspirations were concerned. I think this year will be remembered for HRT's dominance. And I think it's also going to be the year where we remember that Garth Tander really stepped onto the stage. And I think in a few years' time, we'll say, well, in 2000, that was Gabe's championship, but really that was the first we saw of the real Garth Tander. And now we're starting to see Gary Rogers Motorsport move forward. We're starting to see some changes in other teams, and I think that 2001 is going to be an absolute belter. I don't think I'll be spending many weekends at home, Colin.
Well, Jim, between your commitments to the BOC Gas is serious. You've got their next round coming up in the straight A long weekend, and then the V8 season and the rally championship and everything else. I think it'll be a case you write home to the parents and the children say, who are you?
Yes, I'm actually at home at the moment. My son called me Mum before. I think he doesn't recognise me.
Yeah,
one of those things you've got to make up for.
Mm. Now, of course, the other thing which is interesting is the fact that we are very much at the case of people are already into countdown mode, 5 weeks until the start of the World Rally Championship for 2001 with the Monte Carlo Rally.
That's right. There's already one prominent Australian motoring journalist has already started a WRC tipping competition. I don't know, people who tip rallies, oh, God. I suppose it's more straightforward than, or less straightforward than Formula One, because only Ferrari and McLaren really went in Formula One.
Mm.
But, testing is just going crazy. The drivers haven't had any time off. They used to start the season the second week in January at the Monte Carlo, so at least some sanity prevails this time around. But, really, you can't take any gasps now because, or any breaks to have your Christmas dinner, because F1 testing went right up to the 23rd, I think it was, this year. There's still a private test going on at Fiorano. And a couple of years ago, Ferrari tested on Christmas Eve. So it goes all the way through with its rallying. Of course, there's Speedway as well and sports cars. And IndyCars, there's a whole lot of new combinations in IndyCar racing next year, so there's going to be a lot going on.
Mm. And, of course, one of the chief questions will be what will happen with Alex Zanardi once he gets back behind the wheel of a car.
Well, I think Alex Zanardi is going to be a real threat next year. He's with Mo Nunn, who is the guy who engineered him for 3 years at Ganassi's. He's in a Reynard. He knows all the guys at Reynard. He's on Honda, or he's got Honda Power. All the guys at Honda know him and love him, and he's got Firestone tyres. Everybody else has, but Alex has got a lot of experience. I think he's going to be a real threat. I think Vassar is going to be a threat, and I think Herta is going to be a threat next year. And I'm really looking forward to the Champ Car season. What do we have, 11 winners for 2000? We might break that record next year.
And the thing is, too, that if you look at it, it's one of those championships that seems to sort of go through peaks and troughs, and I think we're probably looking at a stage where it's probably building up to a fairly big peak over the next couple of years.
Well, speaking of troughs, I think Ganassi's going to go into a slump. I think Chip's pulled some great coups in the past. He got Zanardi when no one really rated him. He got Montoya when no one really rated him. And he's let Vassar go, and now he's got Manassian and Junqueira. I think they're good drivers. I don't think they're great drivers, and I think Ganassi will go into a slump next year.
Mm.
We can see some good performances from Patrick. They're going to the ovals in Germany and the UK for the first time. They're also going to Monterey in Mexico. So, you know, I'll be madly watching to see which cable company gets Champ Car racing next year so I can make the appropriate investments in my future.
Because this is one of the things we were looking at last week was the issue of mentioning about the huge mega dollars for AFL and the rugby league and so on here in Australia. The fact that they've made the announcement that, you know, Channel 9, Channel 10, etc. have done the deal, but yet Channel 7's still got a few days to go before they have to come back and match it. But potentially with the move of the Australian Football League to television and taking up broadcast time on both 9 and 10, what that can potentially do to their motorsport coverage, I think a lot of people haven't woken up to yet.
Well, I don't think it'll mean big changes. There's a year to go on 10's contract with V8 Supercars. Channel 10 will be showing AFL on Saturdays, and on Sundays they won't be showing much at all. So I think Channel 10 will maintain their current level of interest at least in V8 Supercar racing. I think what it does do is it leaves Channel 9 with Rugby League and AFL on Sunday, providing that 7 don't match it, of course, and I don't think 7 will. So I think that takes 9 out of the running for the future of V8 Supercars. So I think it's 10 and 7 now. I can't see the ABC doing it because they're making sure that they don't show any Australian programming. They should be taking more money off our taxes and not less, but that's just my view. And I think that it's going to be probably Channel 10 in 2002, but maybe Channel 7.
Mm. And of course, the thing is that with not just even the V8 Supercars, when you've got, you know, rally coverage, you've got Formula One, which we've been hard done by over the last year or so with the Channel 9's treatment of viewers of Formula One, and Channel 7, of course, will be looking for something to replace the AFL. So, obviously, they're going to look for anything they can get their hands on that they reckon will rate well.
That's true. I don't know what's going to happen as far as Formula 1 is concerned. I would suggest that it's likely that Channel 9 will keep their deal intact. But if they start to... If their television commitments to football start to go on a Sunday night, why would they want to keep Formula 1? It's not cheap. So I would be betting that sometime in the near future, maybe 2 years from now, your best source for Formula 1 on TV will be pay television.
Oh, well, time to start saving up for the dish.
Well, we'll get to save up for digital first. And then maybe we get Bernie's broadcasts.
Well, that's always a thing to look forward to, because I must admit, I have seen some of the digital stuff with the slow-mo activity they have from the German Grand Prix, and it is, I must admit, very impressive viewing, where you can actually watch the carbon fibre suspension arms flexing as it goes, as the wheel goes over the ripple strip.
Well, one of the interesting things is about the Australian Grand Prix is we don't watch Channel 9, we watch Bernie TV. And some friends of mine overseas watch Bernie TV in Holland, and they say that when Hakkinen took Schumacher on the uphill straight at Spa, it was one of those mind-blowing moments in sport, like great cricketers hitting big sixes and great serves from tennis players and slam dunks. So, hey, maybe people don't mind paying $6 or $7 to watch a Grand Prix if there's something to watch. But at the moment, the television coverage at the moment is, like I said in the magazine a few months ago, C-minus at the moment. If we can get A-plus, I think people might pay for it.
Yeah. Well, here's your little piece of trivia for this week. It was 10 years ago that, basically, about a week ago, that Mika Häkkinen signed his deal to join Lotus in Formula 1, graduating from Formula 3. So look where he's gone in effectively 9 years.
That's right. And is Jenson Button going to follow in those footsteps, or is it going to be Ant Davidson, or is it going to be Mark Webber, or is it going to be Alonso? We don't know what's going to happen in the next decade.
It's all go, go, go. Phil Brangan, thanks for joining us again on Inside Motorsport. The last issue of Motorsport News, it's out there currently, and as I say, some good reading for people to keep them going until over the Christmas New Year break, and no doubt we'll be catching up with you early in the new year to check out what's in the next issue, particularly the Almanac for 2001.
Yes, it's just been cleared by the lawyers now, so hopefully no one will get too offended.
Phil Brangan, thanks very much for joining us on Inside Motorsport.
Phil Brangan there with Colin Ford. And Peter, I know you're looking forward to this next piece after the break, because a lot of hard work and sweat went into your year in review for the kart season, but you got to see a couple of kart races earlier on in the year when you're over in North America. What was the highlight when you were actually there?
In my mind, the kart championship is really one of the leading series in the world, and I always find it disappointing that they have so many sort of corporate battles, and that they're not as successful as they perhaps could be in terms of TV ratings and that type of thing. So any time you actually get to go there live, get to rub shoulders with the drivers and all of that, it's always fantastic, always puts on a fantastic race. And it's always better in the flesh. It doesn't translate as well somehow over the TV.
Well, the kart season in review is up right after this.
Inside Motorsport will return after these messages.
Inside Motorsport, brought to you today by Summernex 2001, the biggest and best car show in Australia. The Summernex Car Festival is on again from January 4th to 7th. There'll be your old favourites, including the Burnout Comp, Horsepower Hero Dino Test, Elite and Street Judging, plus fireworks, super cruises, live music and rides for the kids. Don't miss seeing Peter Brock. He'll be signing autographs on the Mobile One stand. Summernex 2001, Thursday the 4th of January till Sunday the 7th. It's the biggest and best car show in Australia, sponsors of Triple S.
25 years ago, Life Be In It sent a wake-up call to Australia. Being active can be fun, it said, but not only fun. Being active also makes you healthier and happier. Everybody got the message, or almost everybody. But 25 years on, there are people out there who seem to have forgotten the Life Be In It message, or weren't around in the first place. So maybe it's time for another wake-up call.
Be in it today, live more of your life.
Inside Motorsport, from the racetrack to your radio.
This is Mario Andretti for Havilland Racing. Stay tuned for Inside Motorsport and all the news in the world of kart racing.
And thanks, Mario, and to everyone involved in the Kart FedEx Championship for the year 2000. The year started off with quite a few question marks hanging over various teams and other aspects of the championship. Questions like, would Ganassi Target Racing continue its dominance even though they're moving to the Toyota engine, a new chassis, new tyres? other teams with big question marks were, of course, Team Penske. They've been having a miserable time in 98 and 99. Could they get back on top of the sack? As it turned out to be a fantastic year of racing, and the highlight, no doubt, was the very close finish at Michigan. Here's a couple of highlights from kart.com.
The last lap, we've been doing this all day long. Juan Montoya looks to the inside, pulls up and around Michael Andretti, wheel to wheel, off that second turn, down the back straightaway, Juan Montoya with a car length. Oh, who is going to be the last one? Michael Andretti jukes with him. It's Michael Andretti on the inside in turn three. Who's going to win this one? Can Michael Andretti hold off the champion coming out of four side by side, Tom? We've got a left car ahead of them. Here they come down. It's Juan Montoya is able to hold on and come around Michael Andretti. As those two cars came up, it is 4/100ths of a second. The difference between Montoya and Andretti. Brantini winds up third, fourth place, Patrick Carpentier, and fifth goes to Elio Castroneves. Unofficially, we had 55 lead changes. Juan Montoya, what a finish that was today.
Yeah, I think it was really good. I think Target and Taylor did a fantastic job. Now, I was a bit worried before the race, but, you know, we're not close enough, but, you know, we started the race, and when we started dropping each other, it was a lot of fun. You know, everyone trying to save fuel. And the team just fought perfect strategy.
You and Michael, he'd lead, you'd lead, he'd lead, you'd lead. What, it came down in traffic plate a little bit at the very end.
Yeah, you know, it was, when I saw his car, I said he was going to play on my good on his. So I just, kept it wide open until the end.
Leader Michael Andretti, that was great to watch. You even have a smile on your face. What was it like?
Well, it was fun racing with Juan. Juan did a great job. It came down to the lap car, Carson Marks. If all he had to do was pull to the middle of the track and I'd win the race. But he went high, and then that gave a suction to Juan, and that was the difference.
You had a bit of a moment coming off of four. It looks like you guys almost interlocked wheels. Was it as close as it appeared?
Yeah, it was. We were just, you know, it was the last lap of the race. You know, you're going to do whatever you can. And, you know, neither one of us was backing off, and we were all fighting for that draft of Carso there, and we missed it.
And even though they didn't figure in that fantastic race finish, the best comeback story of the year was, of course, Team Penske. Penske took a calculated risk of changing his driver lineup, the chassis, the engine, the tyres, added personnel, new personnel throughout the team, and of course finished up on top, taking out the team and driver championship for the year 2000. Gilles Defferrin was his championship driver. It was a dream come true for Gilles Defferrin, as he was able to benefit from the team's big shake-up. The patience and skill of Defferrin were rewarded by earning the 100th victory for the team during the year, and of course winning the year's Drivers' Championship and a $1 million bonus. Here's what Gilles Defferrin had to say shortly after finishing the final race.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and I've been doing this all my life, so it's a really important day for me. This team is fantastic. It's everything that I hope for, and even more. You know, we always hope to be successful together, but obviously having achieving a championship this early is something fantastic.
Finishing second in the title fight was Adrian Fernandez, as he demonstrated that driver skill is not only displayed by outright speed, but by consistency and strategy. Both Fernandez and his teammate Roberto Moreno were masters of fuel consumption. That strategy paid off on numerous occasions for the Patrick Racing team, a team that seemed to be the strongest in bringing their cars home in the points all season long. Adrian finished with 2 wins and 2 seconds en route to a great year, and although in the final race he went in as a contender, he just wasn't quite able to get the package together to take the victory. Here's what he had to say about the final race and his year.
Yeah, 1 step short, very frustrating in a way, because I didn't have the car to really fight with Gil and with the other guys. I mean, not just with Gil, but with a lot of guys, and that was very frustrating. I mean, we made a lot of changes, drastic changes, to try to cure the push and things like that. And we have a major problem in the middle of the race, and it was just frustrating. I had to hang on there. I tried to make some pass when I could, but then I just couldn't hold it. So it was a little disappointed, but I'm still very thrilled about second place in the championship.
Roberto Moreno ended the season in third, and along the way was able to score his first victory in Champ Car Racing and proved to the team owner, Pat Patrick, that he was correct in giving him a chance to show his talent in a top-notch operation. Roberto Moreno actually led the kart standings for quite a few weeks in the early part of the year, and as I said, he captured his first victory and also the pole position at Cleveland. Kenny Brack was Rookie of the Year and finished fourth in the championship and went in as another driver also in contention during that final race. It was a bit of a long shot. He needed major problems to come between Gilles Deferrin and Adrian Fernandez in the finish line, and as it turned out, Kenny Brack had those problems in the final race, ended up at 13th place, battling a number of problems during the race. He was quite disappointed in his year, even though he finished fourth in the championship and took Rookie of the Year honours, because he didn't actually get to the top step of the podium for any particular race. Finished second and third a couple of times, but he really was frustrated not taking the checkered flag. But he really did show his talent, and he's one to watch for the future. It's just a matter of time till he starts winning the races outright. Team Cool Dream driver Paul Tracy was one driver who made great strides during the year. He's one of the three drivers to win three races, and he was consistently fast and showed more patience and experience this year than in past years, where he was known as a wild man and took unreasonable risks. One of his great drives was Road America. A problem at the start slowed Paul Tracy, and he fell to the very back of the pack. He gathered himself together, got the problem fixed, and proceeded to work his way from right at the back of the field all the way through to first place. A truly magnificent drive, and probably the second best race of the year. As for the championship, he also went into the final race a mathematical chance, even though a long shot. His race came up quite a bit short when, during the early parts of the race, his Honda engine exploded in dramatic fashion, sending debris and shrapnel all across the track. Paul Tracy expects bigger and better things even in the future, and he's definitely an exciting one to watch. After seeing his last two partners win the PPG Cup at Target Chip Ganassi Racing, Jimmy Vassar seems to be a forgotten asset. And during a season in which he was told he'd no longer be returning to the team for the remaining year of his contract for 2001, he proved the naysayers wrong. He finished sixth in the championship, ahead of his highly regarded teammate Juan Montoya, and he won for the first time in nearly 2 years at Houston. And here's what he had to say about finally winning and what it's like to be leaving such a strong team.
It's been too long. You know, we've been in a position to win a couple, but you know, it feels ever so sweet now, you know, leaving the team, and I didn't want to leave on such a sour note. It feels real good.
Seventh in the championship was Helio Castroneves. He joined the Penske team in the wake of the Greg Moore tragedy, but he did put him in the spotlight, and he won three times during the season and finished sixth outright, and made him one of the best success stories of the year. Down in eighth position was Michael Andretti. It was probably the most significant development during the season. It came when he was announced he would not be returning to the Newman Haas Racing for 2001. Andretti is a 17-year veteran of kart and a winner of 40 races, and he's been with Newman Haas for 10 years altogether, including the last six in a row. Michael soldiered on and came close to winning the title until late season's problems took him out of the hunt. He finished up 8th in the championship with 2 victories, and next year he'll drive for Barry and Tim Green in a Motorola-sponsored car, but the defending series championship Juan Montoya was extremely fast again, but he had too many retirements in a package that proved problematic at times, in particular the Toyota engine. Powerful and fast, but questionable in reliability. And that really did cost him any chance of repeating his championship. Montoya, who's headed off to BMW Williams Formula 1 in 2001, but even though he had many did-not finishes, he still managed to win 3 times throughout the year and was able to lead the most laps, secure 7 pole positions, and dominate and win the Indianapolis 500. So even though in the championship standings he was way down in 9th, he really was the star of the year, very fast and consistent. Back into 10th place was Cristiano Domatta, who won for the first time in his kart career at Chicago, and it was really not a surprise to him as he held on to lead with the first Montoya and then Andretti handing him at the end, and he's another driver who's got great times in front of him. 11th was Patrick Carpentier, and believe it or not, he was able to finish the season in 11th place despite the fact that he did not win a single race and he missed 3 races at the beginning of the year due to an injured wrist. 12th in the championship was Christian Fittipaldi, who saved the best for last this season. He kept his car together and survived the attrition and won the season finale at Fontana and claimed $1 million prize money for that race. And here's what he had to say about how he finished the race and some great times to come.
I have to admit that it was 2 very special weeks for me. Like, first, as you said, I'm getting married in the beginning of next year. And obviously that's the most important thing in my life. And I couldn't really have a better day today. Like to finish the championship, we had a very tough season, and to finish the year on a high like this, it's great. And then going into next season like this, it's even better.
So in some respects, that was the highlights of a fantastic year 2000 in the CART FedEx Championship, a year where they had 11 different drivers win across 20 races. There were four first-time winners, and so many others came close. A truly fantastic year, and if only they could convert the excitement on track into commercial success for this championship. Of course, they really are struggling in some respects. They only have a very small handful of American drivers in the series that is supposed to be the American series, and they're up against extreme competition in the form of NASCAR. Top-notch American drivers, it steals the sponsors, and steals the spectators. But it's more exciting times to come, where the CART Championship expands further internationally with races in Europe and also England, Mexico, on top of the existing races in Japan and Australia. So more, and Brazil. So great, exciting times still to come for the year 2001 CART FedEx Championship.
Yes, it's always interesting to look back on the CART year in review. Of course, one thing that stands out for me during the year was the return to CART of an Australian driver, in this case, Jason Bright. But of course, for him, that dream has gone out the window for the moment with his signing with the Holden Racing Team. But Peter, realistically, if you look at, there's a lot of things going on still with the CART season, because they're the same as everybody else. They're in their testing time between this year's championship and the start of the 2001 championship.
Yeah, that's right. The 2001 championship will be quite interesting from another many other respects. Michael Andretti changing teams, and that should be a pretty exciting one to watch for the future. Some of the other sort of stories floating around at the moment is, of course, the big budget Hollywood movie. They're calling it Driven. Sylvester Stallone, we can't pitch him squeezing into one of these cars, but his role in the movie is as a retired driver coming back to behind the scenes to help things along.
They're probably using that special car they modified for Nigel Mansell to fit into the McLaren.
The wide body.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, when I was at Las Vegas Motor Speedway, they said that Sly had hired the track for a week to do some shooting, and basically was hiring the track and hiring some cars.
Yep, and that's right. That movie will be released in the US in the springtime, so sometime around April, and I think race fans will get a buzz out of that one. And it's interesting that they had originally planned to make that in Formula One, but for whatever reasons, they decided to make it in the world of kart. So that may be quite attractive for the kart organisers to help promote the series into the future.
Well, with the series going to America, something that we've talked about is ticketing prices.
That's right. The race fans in the UK have their noses out of joint somewhat. The new track that's being built there called Rockingham Park, the tickets have gone on sale, and many people are aghast to find out they're about 40% over what the US fans pay, and that's after you take into account the US dollar versus the UK pound. Some people are really quite stunned by quite expensive tickets. And maybe part of that comparison's a little unfair, because in the US, in some tracks in particular, like at Houston, the tickets are heavily discounted to try to get some people along.
And the other thing you're probably looking at as well is that Rockingham, you know, the fact that they're going to have to pay for the infrastructure they've put in place, a lot of the other circuits have been in place, the infrastructure's been paid off over time, and they're probably maybe having to contribute to the airfares and so on to bring the teams across from the US to take part in the event.
That's right. The travel costs really are the killer there. And on a very quick comparison, I don't think these race fans are paying much more than what Australian fans pay to see it on the Gold Coast. And that's probably a fair comparison there.
Mm.
Other tracks that are in the rumour mill at the moment is the Vancouver race. It's around the city streets there, and it's a pretty tight, awkward track, often influenced by construction and other things. The word is that race for 2002 may be moved to Montreal, and quite interestingly, it would be on the Isle de Notre Dame, where the Formula One race is held. Modifying the track slightly to uphold the gentleman's agreement between Formula One and kart, but watch out for kart to go to Montreal there.
That'd be very interesting, actually, because I think it could probably provide the most direct comparison between kart and Formula One that we've seen in some long time.
Yes, that's right. And the Kart Boys also announced during the week that 20 of their 22 races will be televised live in the US next year. They think that's pretty important for their future plans. And, of course, their new CEO, his background is all about sports broadcasting. And 20 out of the 22 is pretty impressive when you consider their expansion plans. I guess the two races they're not televising live is Australia and Japan, but it means the European race, the UK race, and Brazil will be televised live into the US.
We hear from the outgoing CEO a bit more detail in as much as what Bobby Rahal thinks of the IndyCar race and particularly the future and potential manufacturers of kart and the potential also of having an international kart series and a domestic kart series.
I was thinking about that just the other day because I remember coming here 11 years ago. I think it was 11 or 12. No, because I came here a year before. I flew down here and I remember going up and meeting with the press in Brisbane and nobody really seemed too excited about it. John, of course, every year we'd come, we'd hear, we understood ourselves to be nothing more than a political football. You know, that whoever was in power was defending it and whoever was out of power was attacking it, even though the guys out of power were the ones who put it in. And we became a political liability depending on who you were. But happily so, this event over the last 3 or 4 years to me has really become something great. When I talk to the press in the United States, and some of these guys can tell you, I always refer to this circuit, to this race, as being one of our premier, by far one of our premier events, because if you look at how to promote a race, you come here and you see the kind of activity and excitement. And, I'd like to replicate this weekend 22 times on our schedule. And if we did, we'd have the most popular series in the U.S. for sure, and certainly one of the most popular ones in the world. Tobacco involvement. It's going to be a factor for the European events, for those teams that have tobacco sponsorship, but I have a feeling that that's going to be an issue before that point anyway with tobacco and motorsports, or sports for all that, for that matter. So I don't think it's going to, obviously long term it's going to be an issue, but certainly up until 2006, I think it's probably going to be pretty much as we know it today. I might add that in Brazil they're talking about the same ban in 2006. So I think that's pretty much a worldwide. I think the horse is out of the barn on that. I think by 2006 it will probably be, if I was a betting man, I'd say tobacco involvement, sponsorship of sporting events will be not be possible after 2006 anywhere, I would say. So the mechanics of getting the approval for a road course in Brazil, irrespective of what had been there before, was purely following on the FIA ruling regarding the categorization of kart as an international series, and therefore there was some willing, and there's an interest in allowing us to perform on circuits that fit. And I will say 90% of our foreign venues want ovals to remain, because frankly it makes a lot of sense for us to be in Europe and the Far East and what have you on oval tracks. But in Brazil, which is much more of a road racing, has much more of a road racing fan and much more of a road racing customer, I think Emerson felt that if we could get the circuit, the road course approved, that would be the best for the event. So both Emerson and I appealed to the ACT, in my case ACTIS, on behalf of CART for the approval, understanding the protocol, ensuring that that we followed the correct protocol so that, in fact, the FIA would approve of that circuit. And obviously through MAX and the FIA, and so that's how the whole thing took place. And of course, as you know, it's been moved, the race has been moved back to its original date. So really the circuit utilizes aspects of the oval that exist and aspects of the current road racing circuit as it exists. So it's kind of a hybrid of both. Look at the series now, and you could very easily have a world oval championship without adding a whole lot of dates. I mean, five more dates, five more ovals somewhere, and you could potentially have the makings of an international championship. Is the demand there for that? I think that's a big question mark, particularly given the power and the strength of Formula One and the popularity of it. I think here in Surfers is a unique situation. And this is an extremely successful event, but could you have two road course events and two major series in, say, Japan? I think that's probably doubtful. So you need to, there needs to be differentiation for the most part. And if you looked into the crystal ball, you could say, you know, 10 years from now, I mean, who knows? But certainly there's enough international interest in karts, in temp car racing, to be able to be, that the ingredients are there to have a domestic championship and an international championship at some point in time. No question that I think there is a concern the manufacturers have, probably based on the fact that they're very heavily involved in Formula One and becoming more so, and yet they have to stay involved in the North American market because it is the single largest market for automobile manufacturers in the world. So our forays internationally have to be probably limited in recognition of how the manufacturers are investing in, you know, what essentially is a domestic series and what is essentially an international series. As I say, in some venues it works, in some venues it may not work in some countries, but there's still a lot of manufacturers that aren't involved in Formula One that could potentially be involved there or in kart at some point in time. Audi, for example, clearly they seem to be casting a lot in sports car racing right now, but is the following big enough worldwide for that to justify the expense? I question that. And there's quite a few other automobile manufacturers who look to the U.S. as being their biggest single market. So I think there has to be a recognition that I doubt seriously the manufacturers want to go out and fund two major international series. That would be somewhat redundant. And so we have to always be aware of that and keep that in mind in what our plans may be in the future.
Yeah, that's right. Bobby Rahal is an interesting one to hear from, jumping into that interim CEO seat for a couple of months and then jumping ship somewhat to go to a better offer in Formula One. He's very famous for business skills and business acumen, and he provides a very interesting insight into the world of kart racing.
Richard Childress owns probably the most famous team in NASCAR racing. Of course, that is the one that has the Black 3, Dale Earnhardt the Intimidator, driving for it. I had an opportunity to speak to Richard about NASCAR and being a NASCAR owner.
Many years ago, and I started out as a driver and kind of worked my way up, and then the opportunity came along to get with Dale Earnhardt in 1981, and I quit driving, became the team owner, and today we have two Winston Cup teams with Dale Earnhardt and Mike Skinner as the drivers, and two Busch cars with Mike Dillon and Kevin Harvick in the Busch. So it's just time and hooking yourself up with really, really good people.
Has being a team owner for you been as enjoyable as being a driver?
Well, each has its own pleasures, and driving the race cars was one thing that I really loved and enjoyed and didn't want to quit, but I knew it took a lot of money to do it, and being a team owner, there's a lot of pleasures and enjoyment out of watching your drivers, watching your teams, and it's a lot of hard work being a team owner.
Is the organization where you really specialize in, is that something that you've got a knack for?
Well, I try to keep everything in an organized manner, but still, yes, you got to treat people like you want to be treated. I did everything on the race cars, from build the engines to drive the trucks and sweep the floors. So I've done it all, so I can communicate good with all of my employees.
Is a team owner like is he like a coach of a team, or is he like is there an analogy there for a team owner, his place in the team?
Yeah, you know, you've got to be a coach, you've got to be a psychiatrist sometime, you've got to be a hard, you got to be really hard sometime, and you got to be understanding. So I mean, a lot goes along with that job.
Because I've never heard of a coach in football say, I've never heard of them sending over a player or players from their team to another team to make it happen. But this weekend I heard that you've got your Busch team helping out Dave Marcus, and it's a very different mindset to the cutthroat. Like, this is a cutthroat business, but it seems you've got time for the people, and everyone's got time for everyone else.
Yeah, you know, you try to help each other out in this sport, and hope that they would look at the same way and try to help you out. And it's really an interesting sport. You never know when the tables may turn and you may need something.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
During the week, Craig caught up with Robin Miller, who's the chief correspondent for the Indianapolis Star.
It is known as the home of motorsport, the world capital of motorsport. And, Robin, the Indianapolis Star is really a Bible for any motorsport fan right around the world.
Yeah, I think I've been here 32 years, and 20 years before I got here, the Star was the only paper in the United States that really covered motorsports on a full-time 12-month-out-of-the-year basis. And, we got two guys here, myself and I got Kurt Cavan, that do most of the racing. And, of course, when we have the big events like the Brickyard, the Indy 500, and the U.S. Grand Prix, we have 8 or 9 or 10 people over there. But we're the only, probably the toughest thing about it is we're the only newspaper in the country that really makes auto racing a priority, and that's probably hurt open-wheel racing. We cover all the IRL races, and we cover most of the kart races, and most papers don't do a third of those races, and or even a fourth of them, and I think it really is, that's something that they need to work on, is they need to have more kind of a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly coverage, and, like they do in NASCAR or Formula One.
Mm. For Australians here, we would only normally see the Indianapolis 500 once a year and not realize just the amount of motor racing that happens just in Indiana alone is probably twice as much as what we experience in the whole country.
Yeah, we got Raceway Park, and then we've got the Speedrome, we've got the State Fairgrounds, that's all here in Indianapolis, and then of course you got about 20 dirt tracks around the state. Just all kinds of midget sprint car racing, live stock cars. It's really and truly, it's really always kind of been the capital of racing, since they added NASCAR and Formula One. I guess it really gives them some legitimacy. But Indiana in itself is always, that's where people have gravitated. Even back in the 40s and 50s, guys will leave California and come to Indiana. That's where you had to make your reputation, make your name. You have to go run Salem and Winchester and the High Banks and prove to people that you were good and brave.
Mm. This year, the elite athletes of motorsport did come and join you at Indianapolis. I guess for ourselves here in Australia, the most amazing thing with the Indianapolis Grand Prix was that it was totally funded by the Holman George family. Not one tax dollar was spent on getting that event there.
Right. Well, I think what you have to realize is that Tony Holman is the man that really rescued the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And while he didn't have his hand out, so to speak, making with tax, he got yearly tax breaks on the 500 that people probably weren't aware of. Plus, the community itself chipped in and they had festivals and volunteers, and it was really a city-oriented event. Tony Holman understood that. He understood that whole formula, that everything that people did for him in Indianapolis was good for his business, and he tried to make it good for their business. So there was a major sponsor, SAP, but Bernie Ecclestone got most of the money because it was his people that found it. So, I think Tony George spent $70 million to bring the Formula One race here. And it was a big success, probably 225,000 people. And most of the crowd was not from here. Most of the crowd was from all over the United States and all over the world.
Mm. One thing I enjoyed about that was Bernie Ecclestone's press conference, when all you fellas wanted to know what the winner was going to be paid in prize money, and he just refused to tell you anything like that.
Well, Bernie, he don't tell you anything he didn't want to tell you, and he's always been like that. Him and I haven't gotten along since I called him at home once a few years ago, and he wanted to know how I got his home phone number. He was a little upset with me, but, he'll get over it. It's just, Bernie's very smart about making money, and he's been very smart about, making Formula One the global success that it is. But Formula One could certainly use an infusion of interest. I mean, the racing sucks most of the time. I didn't like Formula One cars here at the Speedway. This racetrack was nothing. It was no challenge for them at all, and it had some really nasty little windy parts and twisty parts, and the drivers privately all said, this is a Mickey Mouse racetrack. But then, of course, in front of the camera, they say, oh, yeah, we're glad to be here. This is great. Well, they had 225,000 people and a brand new audience, so it was great in that respect.
Is there any work going on at the Speedway to perhaps make it a bit better circuit for the Formula One?
Not at the moment. They've talked about lengthening the track and using the third turn, and that would just be so the Speedway could sell all the seats. But I do think that, you know, it was different. It was neat. But, you know, I like to remember the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for what it was, and that was always for the for Indy cars. I hate the stock car race here. It's so boring. And I mean, the Formula One race was better than the stock car race, and it wasn't much. So it's just that you have to have an appreciation for Formula One, and the technology and the noise and the passion that the fans have is very very rare.
Mm. The Indianapolis Motor Speedway over the last couple of years has been involved in a couple of changes. One is the IRL. Have what you've seen going on at the Speedway and the fans at the Speedway changed with the IRL coming about over what we used to see with the kart race there?
Well, it's changed in the fact that the month of May is now basically the Indy 500 has become a one-day event because nobody shows up for practice and nobody shows up for qualifying. Tony George effectively killed the Indy 500 in my mind by splitting it off like he did. It doesn't mean it's no big deal to win it. It's no big deal to make the race. There's no atmosphere. There's no real anticipation. There's always almost a full house on race day because people can buy tickets for $10 on the street now. And in 1995, you couldn't get a ticket because it was still at a premium. It's just, from my perspective, it's really, really sad to see what's happened to the Indy 500.
Mm. Well, for someone like me who's a former midget driver, it opened up an opportunity to do something that I'd always dreamed about, which was potentially go on to race at Indy. One man that does come from that background, unfortunately, passed away down under in New Zealand this week, and that was Stan Fox, who, for a lot of people in Australia, we got to enjoy his racing on the short tracks here, and of course, for a lot of people over there, they got to see his skills at the Speedway up until he had a rather nasty accident himself there.
Right. Well, I raced with Foxy and USAC for 10 years. We raced midgets together and used to stay at his house up in Wisconsin. We raced at a track up by his home. We'd stay there on Sunday nights. And just a hell of a midget racer, a good IndyCar driver, and more importantly, just a really, really good person. And, you know, he was never the same after his accident at Indy 95. I mean, he came almost all the way back, but he just wasn't quite mentally all the way there, and he knew it. And he got divorced and kind of lost touch with his family, and it was kind of sad to see because he just had so much life. He was just the life of the party most of the time, and as you guys know from watching him down there, he always had a great time racing midgets. Hell, I think his son was born on Christmas Eve when he was racing down under, and he was always gone during Christmas because he was always down there in Australia and New Zealand racing midgets. But yeah, he made a lot of friends down there, and he's really going to be missed.
Mm. One of the big surprises, getting away from that topic, was Turkey Night over there in California. Was that a shock to see Tony Stewart don the helmet and jump back into a midget?
Well, it was only a shock that Joe Gibbs let him do it. Maybe he had Joe Gibbs' blessing, maybe he didn't. But Stewart's just a racer. He likes to drive anything. He'd race every night if he could. I mean, that's just the way he was brought up, and that's why he's as good as he is, because he didn't care what it's got. As long as it's got four wheels and a steering wheel, he wants to drive it.
Mm. And he can certainly drive the wheels off him.
Oh, yeah.
Robin Miller, it's a pleasure to have an opportunity to speak to you, and, of course, for people down under, we can catch your riding via the Indianapolis Star website.
Yeah, it's SpeedNet. I think it's starnews.com and then go to SpeedNet. That's what they usually, they made it a little bit harder to find, but I get letters from people, I get emails from people all over the world, so it's amazing how many people get to read this stuff.
Are you always surprised when people do ring you up or email you with a question, which you go, gee, I can't believe that someone from that part of the world would even know about this?
Well, we have had this, for the last 3 or 4 years, I've done this thing called Ask the Expert on Wednesday. Online, I usually get 150 questions every week from all over the globe about kart, the IRL, Formula One, NASCAR, and it just dazzles me that people take that much time and have that much interest.
Well, Robin, it's indeed a pleasure to have this opportunity to speak with you, and look forward to reading your writings at the SpeedNet site in the future.
All right, well, have a good 2001.
Thanks very much, Robin Miller.
Bye.
Inside Motorsport will return after these messages.
Ollie is an irrepressible 5-year-old triplet. What sets her apart is that she's blind, but that's never held her back. With the help of guide dog instructors, she's learned to touch, to feel, and to listen. By the time she was three, she could walk using a cane. You can help train other blind and vision-impaired children by sending your donation today to the Guide Dogs, P.O. Box 107, Milsons Point, Sydney.
How can I inspire my teenager to enjoy school?
What if my kid is found with drugs?
ParentLink could give you some new ideas. ParentLink is a new service for parents with confidential telephone advice, guidance, referrals and information, proudly supported by the NRMA. Whether caring for babies, young children or teens, now every parent can be well connected. Visit the ParentLink website at parentlink.act.gov.au or phone ParentLine on 6205 8800. We're available after hours and weekends as well.
If you missed the latest race results, take advantage of ACTAB InfoLine.
You'll need to call 6245 1185. For race meetings and result summaries, call 6245 1186. ACTAB's racing information lines. Call 6245 1185 and 6245 1186. ACTAB and Triple S, making betting easier.
If your community group or not-for-profit organisation needs publicity for upcoming events and meetings, take advantage of the Triple SFM Community Magazine. Send the details to us at least 2 weeks prior to the event, care of PO Box 814 Dixon 2602, or fax us on 6247 7066. Keeping you in touch with Canberra Community Magazine on the Good Sport 103.9 Triple SFM.
Inside Motorsport, from the racetrack to your radio.
And in Formula One, one of the young up-and-coming stars is an Indian driver, one who's actually caught the eye of top Formula One driver and former team owner, Jackie Stewart. This interview comes from the BBC World Service and covers his ideas about entering Formula One.
Well, I grew up in a motorsport environment because my father used to rally in the 70s, so that's how I got into, motorsport, but I chose circuit racing because it was a much more attractive package.
How popular is Formula One in India?
Over the last 5 years, it's grown very, very popular on TV, and apparently it's only next to cricket in the TV ratings in India, so it's pretty big.
Now, your family helped pay for driving lessons at the European Racing School, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Way back in 1992, I think I was 16, 15, something like that. I went to the Winfield School in France, where Damon Hill and Alan Prost and everybody else went. They paid for my driving, racing school, and that's how I got started off.
And you're going to be driving in Formula 3. How much would it mean to you to get into Formula 1? Would that be the peak?
Yes, I just won the Korean Formula 3 Super Prix, and also I was the pole sitter in the Macau Formula 3 World Cup. Now it's time to move up, and Jaguar has given me the opportunity to test the Formula 1 car in January, middle of January sometime. I think it's a great opportunity not only to impress Jaguar, but other Formula 1 teams as well.
And Jackie Stewart, I believe, is a big fan of yours. That must be very encouraging.
Yeah, Jackie, yes, because I drove for his team last year. This year in the 2000 British Formula 3 season. I know him quite well, and he gives me advice time to time, and he has a lot of experience. I try and take whatever I can, and we are good friends as well.
Do you worry about comparisons being made with other young drivers, people like Jenson Button? Does that worry you, or do you thrive on that sort of competition?
Well, I drove with Jenson in the 99 British Formula 3 Championship, and 10 races into the championship, I was ahead of him in the championship. But the last 6 races in 99 didn't go very well, so I dropped down. I beat him several times. I think if he can do a good job there, maybe I can also do a good job in Formula 1. You never know until I drive a Formula 1 car.
Now, thanks to the BBC World Service for that one. I suppose, of course, with a driver name like Karthikeyan, it could be one of the reasons why the next interview with Murray Walker explains why he's leaving Formula 1 commentating. Maybe he doesn't want to keep saying a name like that.
Inside Motorsport will return after these messages.
Tick-tock, tick-tock, down the street, around the
is an irrepressible 5-year-old triplet. What sets her apart is that she's blind, but that's never held her back. With the help of guide dog instructors, she's learned to touch, to feel, and to listen. By the time she was 3, she could walk using a cane. You can help train other blind and vision-impaired children by sending your donation today to the Guide Dogs, P.O. Box 107, Milsons Point, Sydney.
Inside Motorsport, from the racetrack to your radio.
I've been promising this interview for a long, long time. It is, in fact, with an absolute legend of American motorsport, none other than Smokey Unick. If I said the word Smokey Unick to you, Peter, what would you actually think?
Bending the rules.
Colin?
Cars that run on petrol that shouldn't be there.
It is an amazing man, and this is his story in his own words.
Raised on a farm, and I was always attracted to noisy, loud stuff. Airplanes, motorcycles, race cars, and always wanted to go fast. And my life was mostly walking behind a horse, and that damn sure wasn't fast enough for me. So when I had a lot of trouble with the horses, I built a farm tractor, and that gave me a little bit of an education on how four-cycle engines work and so on. And then I got interested in racing motorcycles, so I started racing motorcycles. Then I entered, switched to airplanes, and I flew in World War II for 5 years. And then when the war got over, I decided I wanted to go to Daytona, and that was very well known for speed and so forth, and somehow get involved in the racing business. Well, NASCAR hadn't got started yet, but it did as soon as I got there. And of course, we raced under their supervision, and that's how the thing got started. And racing back in those days, it was, I don't know, kind of like how you eat an elephant. It's an impossible thing to understand and know everything about it, but you just keep eating pieces every day, and the circle gets bigger and bigger. And if you study this thing for 50, 60 years, damn it, you don't get pretty smart at what's possible and what is going on and so forth. I wasn't much of a driver. I was a car builder, an engine builder, and that type of a thing. And I had 52 of the world's best drivers drive for me. And I drove once in a while, you know. Maybe I'd be telling somebody like, Pants, you ain't doing it right. He'd take his helmet off and hand it to me and say, show me. And then, of course, you had to go do it. And I wanted to drive. I didn't want to. That's a lot of hard work to build cars and engines and stuff. And it's a lot more fun just driving them, and you make more money. But my wife, she threatened that, you know, she would leave if I started driving. I never had a better offer in my life, but I was too dumb to take it. Back in the days when this thing first started, Bill France Sr., he ran a gas station and a storage warehouse for cars as tourists that only stayed there 6 months a year and they went back north. And so he would work on their cars when they were here and store them over the winter and sell them gas and so forth. And he was a half-ass driver himself at best, and a half-ass mechanic, and he couldn't really wouldn't have made a pimple on either one of them half as a professional. So he found his home in promoting racing, and we were having a problem with it. There'd be a race scheduled in Georgia somewhere, or Alabama or North Carolina, and we come run the race, and then the race was over, the promoter took over off with the gate and disappeared, and we didn't get paid. So Fred Vogt and his car owner started NASCAR in Georgia, and they didn't have time to administer the thing, so they offered it to France, and France then turned it into a Florida corporation instead of a Georgia corporation, and that was the beginning of NASCAR. And then being there from day one, as France experimented with different places and different races, asphalt, dirt, high banks, low banks, 1.5 miles, 2 miles, and so on, we live through all these things and learn how to run these things on the, probably about every kind of race car you can, racetrack you can think of, including the road courses and everything else. We found out that these, we like to run circle track better than anything else, and that seemed to be the biggest crowd pleaser, but we were trying to do it to earn a living, you know. We thought it would be a good way to earn a living, and we really enjoyed it, and same time, so, you know, if you get paid doing something that you really like to do, that's quite a bonus, and that's how we got this, that's how this thing started. A professional racer like myself, we had a social status of about 10 below zero. I mean, we couldn't buy insurance. If I went to the hotel down here and said I need a room, and they asked me the name and address and everything, and said occupation, and I said automobile racer, they'd say, oh, I'm sorry, sir, I just got a note that we're full. They wouldn't rent us a room. We were just trash, social trash. And maybe we were, I don't know. And but today, Christ, Mark Martin, I just passed him a few minutes ago. He's got a Secret Service guy guarding him. The only way that we ever had anything to do with the police is when we were getting in jail or out. It was a totally different life. And the night, the first race we had here in 1960, somebody went through the fence in number three. And they didn't have enough money and stuff, and Curtis Turner was running it. And I was over there at 2 o'clock in the morning welding on that fence, trying to fix it good enough for the race the next day. And when I left at 2, Curtis was still there working. He had to drive the next day. So we had a kind of a tough road. And then we slept in our cars. There were no hotels. We, you know, we had no place we could go. And it wasn't a really wonderful life. It was wonderful to us because we were doing what we wanted to do. They say that I broke all the rules. Well, that's not true. If every place that they say I broke a rule, there was no rule. What I did was cause them to write a very complicated rule book to accomplish what they try to do with one page of rules. It just couldn't be done. Quite simple, reference mechanical, don't do nothing, just have to race them the way they build them. Yeah, that had quite a few flaws, and as they were working them out, the wheels would fly off of them. Some of us would get killed, and some uncomfortable, nasty repercussions like that. And so they slowly changed the rules to make it a little bit safer. And at the same time, they seem to want us to ever go faster. The crash wall thing, I've been bitching about it for 20 years. We haven't made one change since 1900 on the goddamn safety wall. Well, what are you waiting on? How many more guys got to die first? We used to have a saying, you got to die to be written about. And that's the way it was. If we raced here in Charlotte, nobody get killed. They wouldn't even write about the thing in the in their paper. And, of course, that's all changed now, as you know. And the complication expanded and expanded. Finally, I got a belly full of it and told him to stick it up his ass and went off to run Indy cars a while. And I had no intention of ever coming back here, and I never did. And then Junior Johnson, they made a lot of money creating newspaper cliffhangers about myself, you know, as far as illegal, and will it run or won't it run, is it illegal, is it not illegal, and that type of thing. So when I left, Junior took my place and they worked him over until he finally got disgusted and quit. Now they don't have nobody. There's a job open for somebody to replace Junior Johnson and myself as a agitator for the rule book. So how can you break a rule if it don't exist? One thing I do, I irritate NASCAR. They don't know what I'm going to do next, and it's going to make it uncomfortable.
Inside Motorsport will return after these messages.
Hello everyone, H.G. Nelson here, and I'm an amnesty freak. Roy, what is amnesty?
Amnesty International, H.G., tremendous people. I would regard them as the global defender of human rights. And they're having this campaign, H.G., an international campaign that's called Take a Step to Stamp Out Torture.
Beauty.
Yes, and Australians can get involved. We can
How?
All get involved, H.G.
How?
By calling 1-300-300-920. Amnesty International. Think torture, think of getting rid of it. 1-300-300-920.
Inside Motorsport, from the racetrack to your radio.
I've got a question for you. Is there room for a HG and Roy in Australian motorsport?
Why not?
How could they do it? Say, you look at the Olympic program that they did, which I didn't see one episode of. I'll have to catch the videos. But you look at that. Is there room for a program on TV to take the mickey out of motorsport?
Well, I was quite surprised with the Olympic coverage by HG and Roy that I didn't know if their humour would relate that well to TV and to the athletic sports.
Obviously, never watched the ABC before in your life, have you? Oh, you weren't even here. Sorry. I take that back. They've been running a program whilst you were away on the ABC. They even took it to England.
Yep.
It was that popular.
Well, yeah, I was surprised how well that worked, particularly on the commercial TV, and why wouldn't it work for motorsport? There's just as many characters and stuff-ups and funny things that go on. In particular, someone with a cutting sense of humour like that could make quite serious things hilarious.
All right, but who would show it?
Sam Newman.
Yeah, well, that means Nine. Nine's got too much on their plate already. Nine's trying to get Channel 10 to show everything they don't want.
Yeah, I suppose if they want to go to Channel 7, they could always get Andrew Denton.
Mm.
He could be quite cutting, I'm sure.
Well, Uncle Doug, I guess, would be an automatic start-up, I think.
Yeah, if it gets past the censor.
Well, no, once again, he won't be with Kerry Packer. He'll be on 7.
Mm. But just so long as it doesn't turn out like the Sydney version of the Footy Show.
Ned Jarrett will always be remembered for being a hard racer and an honest and fair commentator. I caught up with Ned at Charlotte Motor Speedway and said to him, how hard was it to be unbiased when his son was out there on the racetrack?
Because he is my son, but I try not to let it interfere with the broadcast.
The classic, I remember watching the Daytona 500, and for a long time there, we never had pay TV or cable TV, so we got the Daytona 500 every year, the Indy 500 every year, and that was our American fair, and that was it. And the one thing that I always remember is, you were up in the booth calling Dale, I think, second 500, and they had a camera with your wife.
Yes.
And she was absolutely over the moon, and I'm sure you felt the same, but she certainly gave us the reaction, and you were being very controlled, and it was nice.
Well, as we travel around the country, that particular situation, it was the 93 Daytona 500 and his first Daytona 500 win. It turned out to be a human interest story that CES was able to capture, and I've always marveled at the fact that they put the pieces together and did what they had to do to capture that particular moment, and they sort of turned me loose and encouraged me to be a dad. And the fact that the producer said, as they were coming around to get the white flag, he said, okay, Dad, they call your son home to be a daddy. And so I went from being a supposedly professional announcer to being a daddy. It's something that we treasure, and it's the one that most people remember.
For people who see on the TV, and probably my generation, particularly in Australia where we didn't get a lot of coverage, and what we did get was Richard Petty dominated, you had quite a long career and a lot of success as a racing driver.
Actually, my career as a what is now NASCAR Winston Cup driver, it was called Grand National back then, was relatively short. I only ran about 6.5 years. In the series, and I, of course, got to race against Richard Petty and David Pearson, Junior Johnson, and Curtis Turner, and maybe some of the fans over there have heard of some of those great names from the early part. I know they've heard of Richard Petty. But we were very fortunate in the 6.5 years that I ran to win 50 races and 2 championships during that period of time. Retired at would be considered a very young age, 34, when I retired. I had accomplished the goals that I had set for myself and vowed that however far up the ladder I got, I'd quit while I was there. I would not go down the other side. And also, we were comparing ourselves with athletes in other sports. our sport at that time was not old enough to really, we didn't know how long you could continue to race and be effective. And so we had to compare ourselves with other sports athletes there, and we figured, well, you get in your mid-30s, well, then you're going to start losing a little bit of the edge that you might have had with youth. We've learned since then, certainly, that race drivers can go much longer than that. As a matter of fact, they normally get better as time goes by. And so I don't really have a lot of regret about quitting that early. I would have been interested to see what maybe we could have done if we would have continued on even half as long as Richard Petty did. But we're thrilled with our career and the way that it went.
Then having a son take up racing, I think you have two or three sons that actually race. As a father, are you, when you first saw your son jump into a race car and race, that's a completely different feeling, of course, than doing it yourself. Was there a lot of nerves, or how do you approach that?
Well, certainly it is different seeing your son or your grandson out there. I have two sons, and both of them did. Glenn, my oldest son, did drive some, but he's in broadcasting now. And, of course, Dale has continued to race, and Dale has a son who races now as well. And it is a little bit tougher to see them race. It's even tougher for my wife to see our son race than it was to see me race, because I tell people that, you know, you can replace those husbands, but you can't replace those sons. And so, but it's something that we feel comfortable with. We know that NASCAR does all they can do to make the cars as safe as possible. And so that gives us a lot of comfort in knowing that he's driving as safe a car as can be. And we also have a lot of confidence in him and his ability out there. And so that helped us to go along with his chosen career and not feel too badly about it. But I can say this, that his accomplishments have meant a lot more than any accomplishments that I ever had. We like to see our children good teams. And when he won the Daytona 500 for the first time, and I was in the booth calling that race, that was the greatest feeling of accomplishment that I've ever had, even including winning championships and winning races, because it was so special. And because my son had done it. He passed Dale Earnhardt on the last lap to do it. And that made it very, very special. And, you know, we still are concerned about their safety when they're on the racetrack. But, you know, that is their chosen profession. We know there are other things that they could be doing that would be at least as dangerous, or maybe even more dangerous than this could be. And so as long as they enjoy it and that's what they want to do, that's okay.
What made you go into motor racing?
I did not grow up in a racing family. My dad was a farmer and a sawmiller, and so I worked on the farm and at the sawmill. And then they built a local track, Hickory Speedway in Hickory, North Carolina. And you would go down to the country store on a rainy day, and those farmers and sawmillers, they were all excited about that. Hey, man, wait till I get that track built. I'll go there and show those people how to drive those cars. Well, secretly, I said to myself, I'm going to do that. I was only 20 years old at the time, so I said, I've got to give that a try, because I was a race fan. My dad had taken me to some dirt track races and made a fan out of me, so I wanted to try it. And fortunately, I was able to get a situation worked out. The first race was ever run on that racetrack was the first race that I ever drove in. And once you do it, you're hooked then. And although, you know, for the first several years, it was just something to do on a weekend. Didn't expect it to turn into a career, and certainly not start a family type tradition there. But all of my children, or both my sons, Glenn and Dale, both started their careers on that racetrack. My grandson, Jason Jarrett, started his career on that racetrack. So that has been sort of special to us that we all started a career on the same racetrack.
And then you get to the end of the career, maybe you quit too early, maybe you didn't, but now you're in broadcasting, a second life, still involved in motor racing.
Well, I was very thankful that broadcasting was just coming into the sport when I quit racing. Not television, it was radio then, but I was able to get an assignment, stay close to the sport, and found a new challenge. That was very meaningful, that I was able to find something that was as big a challenge as driving the race car was. And so it helped me forget about driving, not wanting to do that anymore. And it also has served as a good way for me to stay in the sport, make a living from it. And I'm just happy that we could have two careers in the sport. Of course, that second one's about to come to an end as well. And that's okay, too, because I've been around it long enough now that I need to back off a little bit anyway.
When you look at how the cars have developed whilst you were driving them, since you're driving them, you've gone from, well, a jalopy almost to a spaceship. What do you think of the changes?
There have been tremendous changes made in the cars since I drove cars. They were basically stock cars back then. Certainly a lot more stock than they are today. We were not allowed to do a lot of the things that they do today. We had no idea what aerodynamics were, how to play into racing. We didn't have many of the high-speed racetracks, although Daytona was opened in 1959. I ran there in 1960 for the first time myself. And then Charlotte and Atlanta and a couple other tracks came along in 1960. So we began to get some speeds that there were high speeds, and we began to pay attention to the aero package on a race car, but nothing compared to what they do today. And of course, the safety features have improved dramatically over the years as things have happened, and they've seen more need for additional safety features on the race car. Just about every part of it, you know, is hybrid now. Technology has just improved things so much, and it's made for better racing. There's no question about that. The cars that we drove back in those days, the engines would not last very long. If you ran them as hard as they would go from start to finish, you could pretty well just predict that they were not going to be there at the end of the race because they did not have the technology then to what type of metal they needed, what the ratio, the piston size to the stroke, and all of those kind of things. And now, you know, with the technology they have, all of those things are worked out to the nth degree. And you don't have nearly as many cars falling out of the race as you did back then. And you had maybe as many cars starting the race that were potential winners as you have today, but the fact that they would not be many of them around at the end of the race back in those days made it less competitive at the end, at least.
Is racing better now than it was back then, or just different?
Well, it's different, but I would have to say that it's better because you do have more cars that are running competitively at the end of the race than we had back in our days. It was not uncommon to see only two or three or five cars. It's not uncommon at all to see 15, 20, or 25 cars on the lead lap. And if you're on the lead lap, you got a good shot at winning the race.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to have a chat with our listeners here, and we wish you all the best for the future.
Well, thank you very much, and we appreciate the interest that you folks in Australia show for us, of course.
Well, the sprint car season is in full flight, and particularly at Parramatta City Raceway, where over the course of the next few weeks, they will see up to 9 American drivers gracing the green flag there in Wairarapa. Unfortunately, we lost a great champion of Speedway during the week in New Zealand, but we are going to see a lot of other champions from the United States out here at PCR over the early part of the new year, and of course, it all starts on Boxing Day.
Yeah, that's right. Not too many more sleeps to go, Craig, before Parramatta files up on the 26th with American Danny Smith running for the Trevor Shields Royal Purple Oils outfit. Danny will be joined a bit later in the course, probably around about the 5th and 6th of their Bryan Nationals, by about another 3 or 4 Americans. Tommy Tarleton from California. Then you throw in Jason Myers and all those guys, and Donnie Schatz coming over from the West, who are based in California, running later in the season. You've got Chad Kemener coming as well. He's a wild card. He ran very well with the Knight team last year. So they're all starting to invade the place. And of course, on the 29th, we've got a super sedan driver from the south, from Mississippi, Scott Slay.
It is an interesting mixture of drivers from all parts of the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the reasons why we got Scott was because he was from a region that is virtually untapped for international competition. There's never been, as far as I'm aware, a Mississippi super sedan driver or driver of any form of speedway has come down from that state. So we looked at that and we thought he talks kind of neat. He spins the stuff we needed to spin, and he drives a race car pretty well. So we grabbed him, and He had his first hot lap session at Newcastle yesterday, and he won at Newcastle against the pride of the Newcastle and Sydney fleet, with a couple of Queensland stars as well, starting on the Boxing Day show at Newcastle.
Now, you have been working extremely hard with the fellas there at AVE. Of course, World of Speedway has been a great success on Fox Sports, and one thing that I would imagine that you're pretty proud of is that Adam Brand's theme, which you've been using on World of Speedway, got adopted late last year, I think, in about the last race at the Las Vegas race, became the TNN closing theme.
Yeah, that's right. That happened really early this year, actually, because of Brad Doty. Brad's efforts were, instrumental in getting the theme song adopted by TNN, and as a result, they were very happy with it, and it's got the perfect fit, the perfect theme to it. So the Yanks were very happy with it, and as a result, it aired on just about every one of their telecasts from basically Kansas, which happened in June onwards.
Yeah, the funny thing is, though, the Nashville network now is no longer. It's now the National Network, and their ads they're running is that they've got pop.
Yeah, there's a big change that's happened there. I don't know the technicalities of it, but I've also heard that the TNN might not even be handling the World of Outlaw coverage. So it's all up in the air.
That could be a big one, because they were pinning their hat, because they no longer have NASCAR coverage, on World of Outlaws, ASA, and IHRA drag racing.
Yeah, it's been a big surprise for a lot of people. And I know, talking to Brad Doty, he didn't want to say too much about it. You had the real tragedy of Steve Evans passing away suddenly of a heart attack in his hotel room at the Las Vegas race. So it's been a tumultuous year for them.
Yeah, fortunately, we haven't had those sort of dramas here, and Parramatta and Newcastle both have got fantastic programs right throughout this Christmas period.
Yeah, usual busy time, Craig. Nothing ever changes, no rest for the wicked and all that sort of stuff. We really, between the two, and then we've got Gunnedah, we just bought Gunnedah Speedway as well, and between sedans, sprint cars, Corey Kruseman's coming out to run speed cars for the 51st Australian Speed Car Grand Prix, paying $10,000 to win, so where do you stop, mate?
Yeah, it's no end of excitement. But, Wade, to you and your family, a very Merry Christmas, and look forward to having a chat to you once again right out through the new 2001 end of an exciting season.
As always, Craig, I appreciate all your support, mate, and make sure that all of your listeners, drive carefully over the holiday period so they can get to see some of these races, and Merry Christmas to you too.
Well, from Mississippi, Scott Slade joins us on the program now, and Scott, I don't really remember Mississippi being a hotbed of dirt track racing. Certainly you do like your stock cars down there, but how strong is the dirt track?
We have, this upcoming year, we have several big races planned in the state of Mississippi. We'll have three or four races that pay $10,000 to $20,000 U.S. Throughout the state, within about 100 miles of my house. We have one series that is actually based out of the state that travels five or six states.
What division are you running back home?
It's called the Late Models, Super Late Models.
I guess the people that you would have seen driving those cars growing up is the likes of Jeff Purvis and Scott Bloomquist would have been probably heroes of yours.
That's correct.
And lately, have you had opportunity to see much of Australian racing?
No, sir, just on the videos that Wade had sent me. I've been watching some since I've been staying with him and kind of get an idea of what's going on.
How long have you now been in Australia?
This is actually the third day.
And how do you go? Jumping in the wrong side? You're trying to get a drive of the car already?
Yes, we actually did yesterday. And I'm glad to hear you say the wrong side, because I keep telling Wade that and he keeps arguing with me.
Mitch, right. What part of the state are you actually from?
We actually live in Clinton, which is about 10 miles from the capital of Mississippi, which is Jackson, which is actually located directly in the center of the state, north, south, east, and west.
So it does give you good access to not only the southern states, but a pretty short jump up into the Midwest.
Yes, sir.
How long is your tour in Australia for?
I'm going to be here until the January the 22nd.
Well, we wish you all the very best and hope you enjoy, well, running around the clay and dirt of Australian speedways.
Well, we're looking forward to it. Really a beautiful country y'all have here, and we're been treated really nice.
Well, we certainly will turn the good weather on you for you for this Christmas period as well.
I'm not used to it being this hot at Christmas time. You know, it's supposed to be 30 or 40 degrees in this, I guess it's a 90 or 100 here.
You have to get Wade to take you down the beach so you can see Santa coming in on a ski boat.
Okay. First time for that.
One man who's enjoyed racing down under a number of times, firstly in kart and then at Bathurst in the V8 Supercars, is Scott Pruitt. And I had an opportunity to catch up with him at Talladega Super Speedway.
You know, of all the stops we made on the IndyCar circuit, that had to be one of my favorites. And who knows? You know, my wife and I continually talk about, you know, once I hang my helmet up, moving to Australia for full time.
Have you been able to, in the time that you have ducked down there, been able to spend much time there?
Not as much as I'd like. We have had a chance, obviously, going down there for the Service Paradise race, and then going down to Bathurst. We actually tagged on a week there and did a little bit of sightseeing, and it's a great country. I mean, it's the people have always been terrific. The times we've had have always been great, and with all that, you know, who knows? But certainly one of those things we can certainly talk about.
A reasonable amount of success there, too, doesn't hurt.
Exactly. You know, having good success down there and, you know, winning a race. I forget exactly what my record is, but I think I finished in top 10 down there almost every year I've been there. Top 5 most of the time. So, yeah, it's just a great place to go.
So how does an open wheel driver end up in stock car?
That's a good question. Let me see. How does that work? Well, just wanting to, you know, as I've moved through my career, getting the opportunity to drive almost everything there is to drive, with sports cars and Trans Ams and winning championships and winning races and poles and you know, moving my way into Indy cars and now the only place I had left to try and to race full time was NASCAR.
They haven't got this John Andretti deal of wanting to try NHRA.
No. This is about my dessert. I mean, this will be about the end of my of my journey in motorsports, and I was in a position with Cal and with Tide where the right opportunity came about, and it was a tough decision because I was sitting there, you know, continuing my relationship with Cal, or within the IndyCar circuit, or moving here to within Winston Cup, and you know, did a lot of soul searching and thinking, and thought, well, you know, let's give it a go, you know, let's see what happens. So Cal and Tide and myself, we all sat down together and said, you know, I'll commit to you for 3 years. You commit to me for 3 years. We know it's going to take some time. We're all rookies here. We know we have great opportunity in front of us, so let's give it a go.
The money that we see being spent here, like it blows our racing away. We don't have the population for it, as
right.
You saw. But the money being spent here, we think of auto racing and we think of road racing being the most expensive type of motor racing you can possibly imagine. But I would imagine your team isn't spending much less than what they would if they were fielding an Indy car.
Well, it's good that you mentioned that because it's different and you have to look at it a little differently. In Indy cars, you do 20 races. Here, you do 36. So you're going to have the extra cost of doing that. In Indy car, typically you have 2 to 3 cars per team. Here, you'll have 12 to 14 cars per team. Total dollars spent between a team is still a little bit less that gets spent here within Winston Cup than does in Indy cars. But at the same time, you're doing, you know, another third of the races, and we all know how expensive doing a race is, and you're still doing about the same amount of testing as you would. So all in all, you know, the amount of money that's spent here, yet is pretty much on par as within IndyCars, but you're doing a lot more of it. I mean, it starts in February, you do 36 races clear up till the end of November, and it's a long schedule.
Is it a lot of fun going into a sport where it is very single file and you make your move and you plan your move from, you know, a way back, going in, running in the corner, taking tenths every time, but all of a sudden every weekend having 15 cars around you?
Oh, that's been one of the biggest things. There's so many things I've learned this year, it's unbelievable, but It's been a learning experience, and it is totally different. I mean, the way that you run the cars, the fact that you lean on each other, the fact that you will do a little bit of bumping and grinding, some more than others, sometimes more than others. But the most exciting thing is when you come to all these races, the fans are it's the following's tremendous. I mean, every race we go to, there's at least 125 to 130,000 fans, and here you'll probably see, you know, 200 to 250,000 people here for this race, and they do it twice a year here. So it's really amazing when you start looking at those numbers. It's pretty staggering, 36 weekends a year.
Have you had many fans say we followed you in the cup, now we're following
a lot, fans? A lot. Yes, I've had many guys, women, men, families, the whole thing have come up to me and said, you know what, we've been a fan of you for years, been following you in IndyCar racing, and now we're following you here.
And you've all gone silent on me.
Oh, we're just attending to the barbecue.
I'm looking for the fire extinguisher here. I think it's getting out of control.
All right, then. That's it for another week. We will catch you with one show to go. Of course, that will have perhaps some live motorsport coverage in it if we have a little bit of luck.
Inside Motorsport is produced by Thunder Media in the studios of Triple S FM Canberra via ComradeSat with the support of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia.
Very proud of the achievements of not only their players but of course the coaching as well.
Probably because I'm a local girl, like, I got called along to training and we were just training before Carrie came, and then she came along and just picked us, and I was lucky enough to get picked by her.
on the Good Sports. It's 4 minutes past six on what is an absolutely beautiful Sunday morning. I hope you'll stay with us right throughout the morning because we have got a lot of sport to get through this morning. In fact, after I tell you what you can veg out to on the rest of the weekend, we'll speak with Matthew Eggins from 10 Capital Sports News. We'll have a look at the Sydney to Hobart. We'll get all the news from the BBC on football right across Europe. We'll speak to Howard Cotton, the editor of the Sunday Herald Sun. And then we'll have a bit more of a look at cricket, and in particular the Women's World Cup. Gary Morietti will join us a bit later on to talk National Soccer League. We'll have a chat to Robbie Hooker, the captain of the Cosmos. Travis Wilson will join us to talk baseball, along with Leanne Grantham and Natalie Hurst from the Women's NBL. It's a big show for you, and I hope you will enjoy it as well. If you're celebrating Christmas, then I must wish you all the joy and merriment of the season. If you're not, just I hope you're going to enjoy a couple of days of rest and relaxation after what has been a fairly hectic year. Joining me on the line now is Matthew Eggins from 10 Capital Sports. And unfortunately, Matthew, this line isn't great, but I do know that you are enjoying this Christmas period with an extra special member of the Eggins family this year to celebrate Christmas with you.
Every day, Craig, and Merry Christmas to you and, of course, the listener. It's, what is it? It's Christmas Eve, of course, with you. So we birthed our first child back on September 1. And so the it's very much an Eggins family affair.
And a very exciting week to boot with just so much sport going on, so much news in sport going on that you probably haven't had a chance to rest and do the shopping, which, well, I guess they're open for a few more hours today.
Yes, I know. They want to clean the bar. Yeah, people just want to clean the bar. But I'm not going to do that. But I'll be down to my own next week, trying to do a bit of private Christmas shopping for the the number one lady in the
house. Yeah, it's getting to that stage where it's now or never. But, well, hopefully it's not like that for our sporting teams. I guess Carlton in Victoria found out it was now or never this week, but fortunately for us, the Cosmos aren't in that tighter position.
No, I must say, teams only continue to go from strength to strength. For the Canberra Cosmos. Just recently they got on board another sponsor. Their form on the paddock has certainly been much more encouraging than in previous years. And I mean, it may sound strange, but there's even talk that they may even make that all important final six, which is soccer means qualifying for the semi-finals. But Tom Zanardi spoke during the week, it's really important that the Cosmos build on this sort of early momentum and beat the teams that
And the Cannons also going through interesting patches, and this week taking the game to Albury, which is part of Basketball Australia's greater picture. But gee, we really would like to see them a lot more in Canberra.
Yeah, it's just come at one of those. It's come at an awkward time. I mean, there's a theory about Basketball Australia just taking a bit of streets to campaign. Because if you've got it, it takes streets to the country areas, and you think of how many young children become inspired to go and play basketball after seeing some of the heroes on the court. But unfortunately for the Cannons, it's come at a time where they would really appreciate a home game. But they and Perth, of course, are certainly defense to play in Albury. The Cannons went down, unfortunately. But I think that the club itself is only too mindful of promoting the game and going into these regional areas. But
Yes, for football fans coming up to Christmas, of course, we've got the Canberra Roos on for a couple of games in the ANZ Cup. And I had an opportunity to have a look at a few of the packages. I know that Scotty Palmer had an interesting story last weekend where they're talking about getting 7,000 members out of Canberra.
Yeah, I just have to think back. I must have been away or whatever it was, but I'm actually in town for when that actually we had the sports bar award on it. It was a function on Friday. But it's interesting the approach that is coming from the Melbourne people with these
the AFL matches coming up, they want to see bums on seats. And since certainly coming from the Institute of Sport, whenever I'm part of team where there are a lot of sort of expats from Melbourne and certainly over the west there, there is a groundswell, I think, of support for the AFL and that campaign, AFL for Canberra. But I think they're playing a pretty tough, Craig, because if they don't get the numbers on the seats, you'd have to say the future is looking a little shaky. So, you know what Canberrans are like, notorious for purchasing tickets at the last moment. But look, the stage is set very nicely for AFL to receive a bit of a shot in the arm here in Canberra, and we can only wait for those tickets to
come. Yeah, have you had an opportunity to sort of reflect yet, I guess, reflect on what you have gone through in this last year?
Look, I think so. I mean, you think these sort of conversations come up from time to time. But, of course, we recently had the Sports Star of the Year Awards, which Lauren Jackson came away with the big gong, and what a performance from her. She really came of age, I think, you know, all of 19. She came of age during the Olympic Games, but that the athlete is going to win this, pick up a silver medal. But let's not forget Siobhan Payton, 6 gold medals at the Paralympic Games. And I say this, I try to say this in the nicest possible way, but the number of athletes with disabilities who I have seen blossom through sport is just so encouraging and inspiring. And here's Siobhan Payton, who has a mild intellectual disability, getting up on stage, and she had the audience laughing. She was in total command of the people that night, and it was a joy to hear some of the thoughts. And yeah, I can only come away inspired. So certainly Siobhan Payton and Lauren Jackson from some of the locals really left a very big impression on me.
Well, it has been a great year, and Matthew, we look forward to having opportunity to talk with you into the new year of 2001.
Okay.
And I've really enjoyed having these chats in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, likewise. I'm looking forward to getting to know you a bit better and to talk sport and, of course, to continue to fly the flag here in Canberra. Thanks very much, and all the best to you.
This is from a film I really love, Red Rock West, and it's Dwight Yoakam, 1,000 miles from nowhere.
Through things that you say.
Dwight Yoakam on Triple SFM. It is 14 minutes past 7 o'clock, and it's time to go underway. And this week, preview the Sydney to Hobart Yacht Racing Classic. Eventually. Play, damn you. That's always great fun. Here we go. Underway.
Well, thanks, Craig. And yesterday morning, I managed to get hold of Peter Campbell, and we had a brief chat about the starters in this year's Sydney to Hobart Yacht Race. Interesting field, and I'm sure you'll find what Peter had to say most intriguing. The Sydney to Hobart is just around the corner, and we've got a fleet of 80 boats heading south this year, I understand. And the man who knows more about it than I is Peter Campbell. Good morning. And
good morning.
Thank you very much for your time. Peter, I believe two boats didn't make the final scrutineering, is that correct?
Well, not so much the final scrutineering. It was a question that they have to get all their documentation related to safety matters in by 5 o'clock last night. Two boats, Terra Firma and Kintinalong, failed to comply. I think one of the boats got its crew list in about half an hour after the deadline, but at that stage, the race committee was saying they were ineligible for the to start in the race. But my understanding is at least Terra Firma will seek a further clarification from the race committee, and hopefully that they can convince the race committee that they were inadvertently held up and just couldn't get there in time. So, but it's a very strict rule, and in fact that rule was extended from last Monday to Friday.
Exactly.
Friday
evening. Yeah.
So. But yachties are notoriously bad with their paperwork, unfortunately.
I suppose the other thing is, I believe that as a result of the coronial inquiry, some of the recommendations were actually introduced this year, which has meant some boats had to do a little bit of extra preparation.
Oh, yes, there were a small number of boats in the fleet of 80-odd that had to replace their life raft. The coroner listed a brand and makes of life rafts that he suggested were unsuitable for the race. He also suggested, recommended replacing the May West type life jackets, and the CYC immediately followed his recommendations on that, and as a result all the yachts have been able to replace the unsatisfactory life rafts. So that was not a contention. That it was really a matter of just supplying the sailing office here with a compliance certificate, saying that they had, for example, two people with first aid, senior first aid certificates on as part of the crew. Another one was actually providing the crew list, and there were a couple of other things. Nothing very major, but still, there has to be a cut-off point somewhere along the line, and the club felt that they'd bent over backwards to advise people of this, and even personal context. But having said that, there may well be mitigating circumstances that the race committee may well review today. There were two other issues. One, a requirement that the Swedish yacht Nicorette had to have an escape hatch on the foredeck that is forward of the mast, and that Wild Thing, the other, the Maxi from Melbourne, had to have replaced its plastic staunchions. Now, staunchions are the uprights that go around the deck and hold the safety lines around the deck, the fence, if you might like to call it that. I think the yachties do call it the fence.
Yeah.
And in the case of Nicorette, she has put a hatch on the foredeck. They cut a square hole and put a readily assembled hatchway in there. Now, the rules of the Australian Yachting Federation special regulations just say specifically that all yachts competing in this standard racing must have two escape hatches, one of which be forward of the mast. And they've agreed with that, but I'm not sure what the situation with Wild Thing is. I walked down to the dock a little while ago, and it appeared to me she still had her original ones on.
Yeah.
But I do understand that recommendation's probably gone. Interpretation of the rules has backed up the race committee in its decision that they must be replaced by metal
staunchions.
Yeah, so that's...
Staunchions bases have to be made of metal. In most cases, of course, it's stainless steel.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's unusual for a boat to have plastic, I would have thought.
Well, there has been some discussion in a draft proposal that they would allow carbon fibre or fibreglass staunchions to be used possibly from next year when the regulations come up. But in this case, it may be that the owner of Wild Thing may have jumped the gun or misinterpreted what he had been told.
Yeah.
So, in any case, they would have to be proven that they are just as strong as metal.
Right. Now, we've got an interesting fleet, 80 boats, but a very interesting fleet indeed. Now, it's only last year from memory that the first of the water ballasted boats was allowed to take part. Next year we're going to have a whole fleet of them because the Volvo, one leg of the Volvo will be the Sydney to Hobart, and so all of the boats taking part in the Volvo will be water ballasted. How do some of the old hands, like for example the Canberra boat Bindabella, feel about the water ballast?
Well, George Snow came out publicly after the club announced that it would allow water ballast and yachts to compete under the IRC rule, and that does permit water ballast. And you know, he was muttering about it and not very happy about it, but I think he's probably accepted it as one of the things that do happen in yacht racing, one of the advances, and certainly water ballast has proven itself in yachts racing around the world. There will be not only will the Volvo 60s competing this year be water ballasted, but also the Wild Thing is water ballasted, so is Nicorette. So yeah, it not only applies to the Volvo 60s, but it's been introduced in the much bigger boats, the Maxis.
George might be trying to find ways to put water tanks in the Bella for next year.
Yes, I don't think so. I think he's actually explored that avenue and has decided against it.
Right.
It does seem to work very efficiently in long races. Of course, racing in short races around the buoys, it's not very satisfactory because of the time factor. Although, I must admit, they do it very quickly and very efficiently.
Right, and of course, one of the other things, or one of the advantages of the water ballast, is that they can actually carry a slightly smaller crew, and of course the crew don't have to sit out on the rail.
Yes, that is a good point there, and somebody said, well, it's like having 30 extra crew and you don't have to feed them. Not that they feed them much on these boats anyway. Basic meals.
Right, so although I believe that some of the bigger boats do have quite a highly paid cook on board, highly skilled cooks on board.
Oh yes. Well, Marchioness has had a very, very skillful cook on board, but she's not going in this race. She's going north in the Coffs Harbour, Pittwater to Coffs Harbour race, and so they'll have less time to enjoy his culinary pursuits. But certainly they've eaten well on that boat. I think some of the other boats, they're more cruising orientated boats. I think they eat quite well. But on the big Maxis, it is pretty basic food.
Right. Now, the other thing I guess that's worth investigating, in a sense, is that most of the boats going down have got fairly large crews, proportionate to the size of the boats, but there's a boat actually taking part this year that's come all the way from England, Sunstone. And am I right in assuming that that's just the husband and wife?
No. They must carry crew. There is a minimum number of crew, I think, of seven on every boat, so they will be joined by friends who, I'm not sure, I haven't seen their crew list, whether friends have joined them from England or whether they're picking up locals, but they will have to have a crew. They've been cruising with probably them just themselves, maybe one or two other people, and some of them, but certainly in racing they must comply with the with all the racing requirements there.
All right, and so that's an interesting one, and I was going to say they'd probably be, if with just two people on board, with the long range or the advanced weather forecast, they probably wouldn't have been looking forward to crossing the Strait.
No, but basically the cruising people are, they adapt pretty quickly to heavy weather, but certainly it will be a fully crewed boat in this race.
All right, so so they won't be, they'll be doing their best, and I'm probably right in saying that she's one of the, it's a quite a while since we've seen a Bright Finish yacht take part in the race as well.
Which one?
A Bright Finish, what do you call it, Stone Timber.
Oh, right, Yes, she's a beautiful old boat. She's quite a famous boat, has raced in quite a number of fastened races in England. It's done very well on handicapping races over there, and it really is, for a boat that's been cruising around the world for I suppose a year or so, is in immaculate conditions. The top sides are really beautiful. Another interestingly, this week in the Telstra Cup, we had a boat called Kumaloo, which is also an old timber boat and also varnished topsides. And she won the 1968 Sydney to Hobart, and there she was crossing tacks in the Telstra Cup last week with the Yendis, which won the race last year. It was quite an interesting comparison.
Yeah.
Obviously, Yendis was much faster, but she's still around, and there are quite a number of timber boats, but not too many varnished with varnished topsides because of the upkeep required to get that look. But
yeah, it's all right in the northern hemisphere. It's not so good.
No, it's not.
All right. Very quickly, then we've got an interesting range of boats taking part this year. There's been some conjecture as to whether the water ballasted boats will be able to outgun the maxis. But what's Peter Campbell's tip for this year?
Well, my tip actually for liners, two boats I think are going to be really outstanding, and that's Nicorette and Shockwave. I think they're the outstanding boats in all round conditions. I'd never discount Brindabella because she's a fine boat, and she, if it's a hard race, she will still go well in that.
And she's got a very competitive skipper.
Absolutely. He's taking his two sons and a daughter on board with him this year.
Good on him.
Which makes it, you know, a very nice family combination there. In fact, there are quite a lot of families in the boats this year, so it's very much a family pursuit there. But I think Nicorette and Shockwave are going to be the two ones out in front.
Yep.
In all conditions, have a very fast running race, which I don't think it will be very much. There's a boat called Zinner, beautiful looking boat, red hull, spectacular boat, and in a hard running condition, she'd be very hard to beat. And of course, so with the Volvo 60s.
Right, I guess the other thing that is worth mentioning is that those Volvo, the water ballasted boats, run very well before the wind, but they don't necessarily perform all that well into it.
No, they don't. They don't go as well to windward as boats like Shockwave or Brindabella or even Nicorette. But certainly in what they call power reaching, which is the wind on your beam, either with the spinnaker or two sails up, they are very, very fast in those conditions because they really are designed for round the world racing. And the way the Whitbread, as it was now called the Volvo Ocean Race, is concerned, it does follow the trade winds round the world. They certainly do get a lot of windward work, but I think a majority of that is running and reaching conditions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. We'll be looking forward to keeping tabs on the field. I suppose it probably won't be a record-breaking year.
I don't think it'll be a record-breaking year, but it'll be a great race south.
And it always is an intriguing trip south. The people who take part in the race certainly always looking forward to it, but it is becoming more and more expensive for those who want to take part in the Sydney to Hobart Yacht Race, but safety must always be a concern. That's it from us, for me, for this week, or for now. And we'll be back on Thursday morning with another edition of Underway.
For the very best in country racing action, be at Queanbeyan this Tuesday. Q Racing is holding its traditional Boxing Day meeting, sponsored by Jim Murphy Market Sellers and Carlton and United Breweries. This meeting is one of Q Racing's most popular days of the year, and the five-race program will provide plenty of action. So folks, there'll be no better way to wind down after Christmas Day than being at Q Racing's Boxing Day meeting this Tuesday. Further information on the internet on www.qracing.com.au. Q Racing, supporters of SSSFM.
I inspire my teenager to enjoy school.
What if my kid is found with drugs?
ParentLink could give you some new ideas. ParentLink is a new service for parents with confidential telephone advice, guidance, referrals and information, proudly supported by the NRMA. Whether caring for babies, young children or teens, now every parent can be well connected. Visit the ParentLink website at parentlink.act.gov.au or phone ParentLine on 62 05 8800. We're available after hours and weekends as well.
And Triple S FM 103.9. I'm glad that you're staying with us right throughout Sunday morning sport, where the time is almost half a minute away, in fact, from 7:30. And I would just like to wish you all the best if you celebrate Christmas. I wish you all the best for Christmas. If you don't, have a good couple of days off. Normally at this time we would speak with Mark Schroeder from the National Basketball League, but as it's Christmas, he's gone up north to have the time with his family, so you'll have to bear with me talking about something that I know very little, but then again, I do it for 3 hours. The NBL Tigers, well, Perth completed a clean sweep of their two-game away trip, defeating the Tigers 126-116 in the National Basketball League. The Wildcats blew the game away in the third period with a 42-29 quarter, setting up a 16-point lead before the final change. The Adelaide 36ers forward Paul Malley celebrated his 250th game in the league, and he had a starring role in his side's 109-93 win over the Cairns Taipans in Adelaide. Marley sparked a 12-0 run for Adelaide in the third quarter after the home side had trailed by 2 points close to three-quarter time. For Damian Lowry, he buried 2 free throws to give Wollongong a heart-stopping 111-109 overtime victory against Canberra. Wollongong went into the final quarter leading 74-67, but a 3-point blitz by Andrew Clark got the Cannons within striking distance. West Sydney, they have ended a 7-game losing streak by thumping Brisbane 114-92 in their league match at the State Sports Centre at Homebush. The match was marked by West Sydney's forward Bruce Bolton's 400th NBL game, but the star of the show was his teammate John Riddle, who hit a game-high 28 points while following guard Derek Rucker, who bagged 24. Yaya Dia with 18 points. So an interesting set of matches and set of rounds, in fact, closing out what was this round, I think number 10 of the National Basketball League. Football fans, sit back, relax. We go to the BBC right now for all the news of overnight football from Europe.
Manchester United taught Ipswich Town a premiership lesson.
Here's a ball forward and it's taken down by Solskjaer, is onside! And what a finish! What a terrific finish by Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. His second of the game, 31 minutes played. And Ipswich are getting a lesson here. It's Manchester United 2, Ipswich 0.
Second-placed Arsenal were on the receiving end of a Liverpool landslide.
Heskey now to Barnby. Barnby on to Fowler, into the penalty, I got Meninga, and Fowler scores for Liverpool. Just what he needed in the final seconds of the game. Both arms aloft from Robbie Fowler. Anfield celebrates, and Arsenal, undeservedly, have been thrashed. Liverpool 4, Arsenal 0.
And it's business as usual in Scotland. Celtic, the leaders, won 2-0 at St Mirren, and Ronald de Boer gave Rangers a 1-0 win over Hibs. For now, these are the main results from England and Scotland. FA Carling Premiership, Charlton Athletic 1, Everton 0. Chelsea 3, Bradford City 0. Derby County 2, Newcastle United 0. Leeds United 1, Aston Villa 2. Leicester City 2, West Ham United 1. Liverpool 4, Arsenal 0. Manchester United 2, Ipswich Town 0. Sunderland 1, Manchester City 0. And Tottenham Hotspur 0, Middlesbrough 0. In the Bank of Scotland Scottish Premier League, Dundee 2, Aberdeen 2. Dunfermline Athletic 1, Kilmarnock 0. Hearts of Midlothian 3, Dundee United 1. Rangers 1, Hibernian 0. St Johnstone 2, Motherwell 3. And St Mirren 0, Celtic 2. So, Manchester United are 8 points clear at the top of the Premiership after their win and Arsenal's defeat. The story of their 2-0 win over Ipswich today comes from Dave Woods.
A near-perfect first 45 minutes by Manchester United provided the platform for the win that puts them 8 points clear at the top of the Premiership. But credit Ipswich, who found themselves up against flawless opponents in the first half, yet who showed enough character to make it a much more even contest in the second half. United's goals both came from delicious moves, both finished stylishly by Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the first after a 1-2 with Ryan Giggs in the 21st minute, the second 10 minutes later from a perfectly flighted through ball from David Beckham. United started the game without Butt, Cole, Sheringham, York, Stam and Irwin, and finished without Keane, Beckham and Giggs, so plenty in reserve for the second half of the season.
So Ipswich Town rather drop from third to fifth place. Here's what the Manchester United manager Sir Alex Ferguson had to say about it all.
I think the players were ready for it. They were disappointed about last Sunday, but they've answered the best possible way by recovering with a really good performance.
I mean, it's also important, isn't it, that you see how they bounce back from a disappointment, and that was pretty emphatic.
Yes, there was an excellent performance, and it could have been more at half time, but the most important thing was the expression of the game, and the performance level was very, very good.
To be without the three strikers you were without today would have been a crisis for some clubs, but I mean, Solskjaer's in there and two great goals.
Oh, magnificent goals. Particularly his second goal was just stunning. And the lad is one of the best finishers I've ever known.
8 points clear. Now, I know you don't win the championship at Christmas, but you're giving yourself a great chance, aren't you?
Well, if we get to New Year Day and with a healthy lead in, we'll have a big chance because, you know, historically we do well. March and April is always a test for everyone, and that's when we'll find out.
Well, last weekend Manchester United lost to Liverpool, but today Liverpool did them a big favour by beating Arsenal, and how, 4-0. Mike Ingham reports.
Well, Croatian Igor Biskan must think English football very straightforward. In his first three Liverpool starts, 3-0 against Fulham, 1-0 at Manchester United, and a slightly flattering 4-0 today. All the goals from Englishmen. But the Englishman who didn't score, Emil Heskey, was the biggest single difference between the sides. Arsenal had no answer to his aggression and work rate. Quality, Arsenal's own strikers, continue to lack away from home. Heskey's threat produced the panic which led to the first goal after 10 minutes from the outstanding Gerrard. Either side of half-time, Arsenal had threatened to equalise until Heskey created the opening for Owen's decisive second. Barnby and Fowler's efforts afterwards, though beautifully taken, almost academic. As is the debate up front for Liverpool, Owen and Fowler on the second row of the grid still, behind a man in pole position from Leicester.
So Liverpool up to fourth place, just 2 points behind Arsenal, but in between come Leicester City. They beat West Ham today, 2-1 at Filbert Street, and Simon Hill was there.
Ever heard the saying, don't let the, insert expletive, grind you down? Well, I wouldn't be so unkind as to label Leicester as that expletive, but the saying certainly rings true for visiting sides to Filbert Street. West Ham had plenty of opportunities to gain at least a point and extend their unbeaten run. They certainly played the better football, but in the end, they left with nothing. The Hammers deservedly took the lead as early as the 7th minute, thanks to Freddy Kanute's sharp drive, and with the Frenchman leading the Leicester defence a merry dance, an away win seemed a good bet. But Leicester merely dig in when their backs are to the wall. They bundled in an equaliser through Muzzy, is it? Almost like a rugby pack drives over the line, and West Ham's passing game was abruptly halted. The decisive moment, though, came on 62 minutes. A long ball completely befuddled Ian Pearce, and Robbie Savage stolen behind him to score the winner. West Ham, though, still had ample scope to equalise. Camara missed three good chances, Song went close, and how Sinclair fired wide in the last minute, only he knows.
Well, reflecting on a very satisfactory first half of the season, here's the Leicester manager, Peter Taylor.
I think we've done well. We've been quite consistent. And 35 points from 19 games. I think everybody would have grabbed that at the start of the season, so I'm very pleased.
If people say to you, you're overachieving, is that unfair then?
No, I suppose the size of the club and the size of the squad, you know, we've done very well, and we have to rely on people keeping good form and staying fit. But for the players that we've got here, I've got every faith in them, and they've done superb.
Also in the top six are Sunderland. They beat Manchester City 1-0 at the Stadium of Light today. Peter Slater saw that one.
Six identically dressed Father Christmases were a reminder of the festive season. There was little charity on the field, although City perhaps gifted Sunderland the game's only goal and then had to fight like tigers to try and retrieve the situation. But it wasn't their day. Mark Kennedy's early injury meant they had to alter their formation. The Goats squandered chances. Sean Wright Phillips struck a post. Sunderland's Emerson Tome nearly sliced a clearance into his own goal with just about the last kick of the game. City were chasing from the 19th minute. Don Hutchison took a quick free kick whilst their defence slept, driving it beyond the wall. Nicky Weaver's hand helped it in. Weaver couldn't be faulted with the save of the match, one-handed to turn away an audacious long-distance lob from Niall Quinn. It was a Gaelic football attempt, that one. City's league position now gives cause for concern. Sunderland stay in the top six. But there wasn't much in this, believe me.
Well, Robbie Keane made his Leeds debut today. He came on for 20 minutes as a substitute, but nonetheless, Aston Villa beat Leeds at Elland Road 2-1. Here's the Villa boss, John Gregory.
So they passed the ball very well. I think in the first half we were surprised, really, that we had a lot of room in which to play. With Merson pulling all the strings in the centre midfield, which he did exceptionally well, and Hendry using the ball well, we deserved that 1-0 lead, and it was Southgate again on the sheet. I think the last time he scored was against Leeds.
He got two last time, only one this time, so he's slipping a bit.
But it's funny, we talked about it before the game, and it's funny how those things tend to come round, and I think we were just very pleased that we kept Robbie Keane off the score sheet more than anything.
And a good win for Derby County today. They're now fifth from bottom, having beaten Newcastle 2-0 with goals by Carbonari and Burton. Good win too for Charlton. They beat Everton with a Matthias Svensson goal. And Chelsea's good home form continues. They beat the bottom club Bradford with goals by Poyet, Dalabona and Gudjonsson. Now let's have a look at affairs in the Scottish Premier League, where third played second today, and Rangers, who were third, still are, beat Hibernian by a goal to nil. Roddy Forsyth was watching.
A few minutes from the end of this riveting contest at Ibrox, the assistant referee on the main sand side wrongly awarded Hibs a throw-in. Not, you would imagine, an event to stop the stars in their courses, but it had the Rangers fans seething. One man, in fact, was hopping in circles on the spot in sheer rage. That alone should give you some idea of the intensity of this contest, and anybody who supposed that Hibs would rest on their comfort margin of 5 points over Rangers was soon disabused. Tactically, the game remained on a knife edge throughout. Passionately, the match never lost its fervour, and by the end, referee Kenny Clark had booked seven players and sent Jerk Alberts of Rangers and Hibs' John O'Neill off. It was settled 4 minutes after half-time when Neil McCann got clear on the left and found Ronald de Boer for a scoring header, and that was, on balance, fair, because Hibs never quite managed to fashion such a clear opportunity. In fact, both sides removed strikers before the second half, Hibs replacing David Zatelli for his own good 5 minutes before the break. The Frenchman had been booked and was heading for a red card, while Rangers relieved Michael Moyles of his duties simply because nothing was happening for the Dutchman. As for the referee's performance, it wasn't one of Kenny Clark's better games. Alberts went off for gripping Gary Smith warmly by the throat, but Smith had kicked the German first. O'Neill walked for aiming a kick at Rayner, but Frank Sozzi didn't get a caution for scything into Neil McCann in the closing minutes.
So a goalless draw for Spurs today in their first match since the chairman, Alan Sugar, announced he was selling up. And today Sugar has heavily criticised the club's supporters. Many fans turned on him this season, accusing the chairman of lacking ambition and commitment. But he says those supporters are simply unrealistic and living in the past.
I'm not prepared any longer to put up with the abuse from fans. It's an untenable situation, and I don't need it. I don't need to have that aggravation anymore. I don't need to constantly worry all day long about Tottenham and what we can do and keeping things in shape and keeping everybody happy in the back room with players and contracts and things like that. And then, you know, you don't mind being rewarded for something, for working hard at something, but when you don't get the rewards for it, or the thanks for it, or any recognition for it, it's just a total, absolute waste of time.
The English Football Association has announced plans for a $59 million national centre of excellence in an attempt to emulate France's success. The FA's chief executive, Adam Crozier, told the BBC that the centre, which will include coaching, medical and research facilities, was based on the French version at Clairefontaine near Paris. The FA hope the centre will open within 2 years. In Italy, after Roma's 0-0 draw with Juventus on Friday night, Atalanta missed the chance to go second in Serie A today. Meanwhile, AC Milan endured a miserable afternoon at the San Siro. All the news of the day from Simon Evans.
AC Milan and Atalanta both missed out on opportunities to close the gap on six-point leaders Roma as they fell to their first home defeats of the season on Saturday. Milan fell to a surprise 2-1 loss at home to Perugia, with Greek striker Zizic Vrizic grabbing the winner after Andrei Shevchenko had cancelled out Luka Saudati's opener for Perugia. Inter Milan finally got their first win on the road thanks to a second half goal from Dutch midfielder Clarence Seedorf, which sank third place Atalanta. Parma stay on the fringes of the chasing pack after they were able to take a point from struggling Napoli. Yugoslav striker Savo Milosevic looked to have sealed a 2-1 win for Parma, but Napoli's Nicola Amoruso grabbed an equaliser 6 minutes from time. Fiorentina's good run continued with the in-form Enrico Chiesa scoring both their goals in a 2-0 home win over Verona, while bottom club Regina recorded their first victory since the opening day of the season with a 1-0 win over Vicenza.
The veteran Brazilian striker Romario says he's ready and willing to go back to Barcelona at the age of 34. Romario scored a hat-trick in the recent Mercosur Cup final for his current side Vasco da Gama in Brazil and believes he's in the best form of his life. Romario left Barcelona in 1995 after two seasons there, but he says it's the one club he'd still like to play for. One Brazilian striker definitely on his way back to Spain is Denilson, once the most expensive player in the world. Real Betis paid $35 million for him in 1998, but loaned the player to Flamengo after their relegation from the Primera Liga. Now he's been recalled until the end of the season as Betis attempt to secure promotion.
In goes the throw from Babel, aimed towards Heskey, away by Vieira. Gerrard there!
And scores for Liverpool! Steven Gerrard with a terrific strike. Liverpool 1, Arsenal 0.
Heskey turning with Keogh. He goes past Keogh. Emil Heskey, saved by Manninger. He goes away! And it's 2-0 for Liverpool!
Biska finds Schmitzer. Schmitzer running through the middle and played it through. Barmy must get a third. Gets it over the goalkeeper. And Liverpool have beaten Arsenal. Heskey now to Barnby. Barnby under Fowler, into the penalty, high gun Meninger, and Fowler scores for Liverpool, just what he needed in the final seconds of the game. Both arms aloft from Robbie Fowler, Anfield celebrates. Liverpool 4, Arsenal 0.
And the BBC World Service there with all the news from football. I hope you enjoy hearing that, and of course if you're a Liverpool fan, you would have enjoyed that even more. I know as a Man United fan, it was good to see Liverpool get a win this week anyway.
My son came home from school recently quite upset. Now, he's only in grade 2, but he heard an older kid in the playground say something about a will. Well, naturally, he asked the question, what's a will? You know what one of them said? It's when your parents die. Well, what do you say to that? Yes, it is. No, it's not. I mean, how do you explain to a kid about death? And more to the point, how do you explain that parents, like all people, die? And that some parents forget to make a will and don't get to have their say on exactly who gets what and who takes care of the kids and all that sort of stuff. It's a tough thing to tell a child. But, you know, I did my best and I reassured him that his mum and me did have a will. We got one of those Australian legal will kits that you order over the phone. Well, they're only $29.95 plus postage and handling.
To order, call National Direct now on 1-800-246-868. Write the number down, 1-800-246-868. Call now, 1-800-246-868.
Sponsors of Triple S.
Ho, ho, ho from all of us here at Triple S, and we wish you a happy, healthy and safe festive season. It's been a big year for sport and racing, locally, nationally and internationally. Next week we give you a chance to vote on your top moment in 2000 when the breakfast show goes into party mode. Next week, the Blue Water Classic, the Boxing Day Test, orienteering, surfing, tennis, golf and plenty of local racing on the Good Sports 103.9 Triple S FM.
At 13 minutes to 8 o'clock, it's time to look at the papers today. And sport on the Canberra Times is not only back page, but front page, of course. The photo on the front cover is the New Zealand cricketers overjoyed with their success at the... At the Lincoln Oval, I think it's... was there in Christchurch where they took out the Women's World Cup. The story on the front page that caught my eye was the smoking to be banned at Bruce Stadium. Smoking will be banned as from January the 1st. The Stadium Authority Board, under Chairman Tony Blunt, decided to adopt the smoking restrictions already applied to buildings across Canberra under the Smoke-Free Areas Act in the ACT, so I guess you can't puff down a quick one now at Bruce Stadium. Normally we would be speaking at this time to, of course, Michael Stevens, the Sunday Times editor of sport, but a lot of our guests, regular guests, they're enjoying their Christmas time. So I'll just run through quickly before we go to Howard Cotton. On the back page of Sport Today, of course, more news about the World Cup nail-biter in New Zealand. Lee being forced out of the series. The Cannons going down in an overtime loss in Wollongong. And the AIS also having an interesting match there last night. Of course, Laura Summerton, who's tipped to be the next Lauren Jackson, having a interesting game there. In motor racing news, there is a report there on the Italian Formula One driver, Jarno Trulli, who has accused Ferrari and other teams using traction control devices whilst they're still illegal. Of course, another report there for the Cosmos fans. Not good news with their result going down to the Eastern Pride 3-1 yesterday. Plenty of basketball news from across the sea. And, in fact, a good look also at the Blue Water Classic that is the Sydney to Hobart Yacht Race. And, of course, don't forget all the Sunday racing action. And on Triple SFM, coming up in about an hour and 10 minutes' time, of course, Hamish with the South East Racing Review. So that's what's in the paper Canberra Times-wise today. And now joining me on the line from the Sunday from the Sunday Herald Sun is Howard Cotton. And, Howard, of course, plenty of cricket news to lead off as you get set for the Boxing Day Test.
Yes, Craig. Well, our front cover is, on, as you say, on Brian Lara. A bit of a scare for the West Indies camp. It's something they probably don't need with the last two tests coming up. They'd like to obviously redeem themselves 3-0. They'd like to at least get one, hopefully two tests back on the Australians. I know the series is gone, but Lara was in the nets yesterday and he tried to sweep a delivery, it caught the top edge, flew up and hit him in the left eye. So that's the last thing they really knew. He was checked out by the team physiotherapist and he has been cleared of bone damage and it's just bruising. So just a scare for Lara, but something that the West Indies certainly didn't need. On the debit side, as far as the Australians are concerned, there is a little bit of bad news there with Brett Lee flying back to Sydney for more tests. So he's definitely not playing, which is a big blow for the Boxing Day crowd. And the Boxing Day Test, of course, is where he started his run last year against India. And who can ever forget that performance? It was a fantastic performance, but unfortunately we won't be able to see it this year. And we're hoping that the Australian captain, Steve Waugh, will be there. But we won't know until tomorrow, because he'll be tested for the see if he's actually overcome the muscle tear in his buttock. Of course, if he fails that fitness test, Damien Martin will retain his place, and one would say, you'd have to say, it's pretty deserving of retaining his place in the team.
Well, a Victorian who would be looking forward to getting a Santa Christmas present by being named in the side is, of course, your own Colin Miller, who perhaps has got a spot in the side with Lee going home.
Yes, I would say that he would, and I would say that he would probably get a game even ahead of Stuart McGill if it came to that. I mean, I think that you'd have to say that Miller did everything right in the Adelaide Test match. 10 wickets, tremendous performance, and knows the Melbourne wicket pretty well. And I think he'll be a bit more than a handful for the West Indies again here in Melbourne. Who knows how the wicket's going to play? It's a portable wicket. It's been brought in for the Test match. Tony Weir has said he's confident, the curator at the MCG, says that he's confident that the wicket will hold together for 5 days and be a very good cricket wicket. Of course, we didn't see that in Adelaide. The wicket cracked up quite noticeably, particularly after the third day, which helped Miller. Now, whether that same occurrence is going to occur or going to happen in Melbourne will yet to be seen. Of course, we hope to get on Boxing Day. The forecast, as we know, it can be a little bit fickle down here. We admit that. But the forecast at the moment is for a fine Christmas Day, but maybe a shower or two on Boxing Day. Now, what that means, who knows?
I remember seeing 1.5 days of Test match cricket when South Africa returned to Melbourne there at the G.
Yes, I remember that too. That was certainly one of the worst. But of course, last year there was a time there where it looked as if we wouldn't get on. We eventually got on. I remember going up and being arriving at the ground at 2 o'clock, and I think I missed the first five overs, and we were got through to all 5:40 until light closed in, and there was a little bit of drizzle and rain. And then the next day, so we got three and a half hours on, and then the next day I think we got about 4 hours, and then there was an almighty storm hit and flooded the ground as badly as I think I've ever seen the MCG flooded. And of course there was all sorts of flooding around the suburbs and what have you after that storm. But remarkably, I think we got on time the next day, and we also got a result in that test. So generally, the drainage at the ground now is such that it can really withstand a lot of rain.
I guess the only thing you would hope for is not a big gust of wind.
No, well, we saw that today, yesterday, I should say, at the at Christchurch, and I would care to suggest that certainly. In that very controversial dismissal of Catherine Fitzpatrick in the Australian innings, I would contend that it was more the gust of wind rather than the ball actually hitting the stump that caused her dismissal. And of course it was a rather controversial dismissal, and it was the ninth wicket for Australia, and Australia still requiring I think 10 runs at that particular time. And of course, she was given out by the third umpire. Now, it brings into question the role of the third umpire. I mean, the third umpire, a lot of people around the cricket world have been saying the third umpire should be given more power. Now, after this particular incident, I care to suggest that maybe that policy should be reviewed, because it certainly was a decision that from looking at the replay, I couldn't quite understand, it certainly looked to me as if it clearly missed the stump. The only thing was that the bail seemed to blow off at exactly the time the ball passed the stumps, and that seemed to give the third umpire the impression that the ball actually hit the stump. I can't see how he actually saw that, but that is how he's adjudicated, and it seemed to it certainly was a very crucial decision at the vital time. And I think it, as I say, it brings into question the role of the third umpire and how much power the third umpire should be given in a match. And there's talk about LBW decisions and all sorts of things, and really I think that run outs, stumping's fine, but I'm not so sure about some of the other powers that maybe third umpires, the third umpire maybe has been talked about should be given. I'm not sure that would be the right way to go.
But to the Australian women's credit, they're not blaming the third umpire. They're topping it on the chin, as it were, and will be official guests of the cricketing public and Commonwealth Bank at the Boxing Day Test.
Yes, there'll be a motorcade, and they'll be given a great reception, I'm sure. They've been fantastic ambassadors for Australia, and they've been fantastic cricketers. I mean, Belinda Clark today played a superb innings from what I saw. She was just fantastic. And, some of the others, girls, I mean, Zoe Goss hasn't been, she's had a couple of years or a few years in the wilderness, but she's back in town now. She's back in the Australian side anyway, and then some of the other, Karen Rolton has been in very, very good form. Lisa Kiteley's been in very good form. Unfortunately, they weren't able to produce it on the day today, yesterday, but you'd have to say that they've played exceptionally well. They were unbeaten up until today's game. They were narrowly beaten in the final, and I think they did us pretty proud.
It's been an interesting week in football. We've had presidents of one club telling the Roos to get up to Sydney, and the AFL should give them a helping hand. And overnight there has been some more news and some trouble on field and off field for the Blues.
Yes, there has been, Craig, and as a bit of a Blues follower, not pleasant news from either angle, really. On Friday night, there was a press release announcing the resignation, sudden resignation, of the Blues' new chief executive, John Guerrieri, new as in the sense that he hadn't been in the job a year. The previous two chief executives, fairly well known, Ian Collins, of course, who's gone on to be head honcho at the AFL and also now at Colonial, and then Stephen Gough, who's now, of course, the head honcho at the MCs at the Melbourne Cricket Club. So two well-known figures, and were in the job for 19 years combined, and now, of course, we've had John Guerrieri, who was only been in the job just under a year, and has announced his resignation, citing personal reasons, family reasons, and wanting to pursue his own business. So a bit of a shock. The interesting thing was at the Carlton annual meeting on Wednesday night, there was no inkling of this. John Guerrieri was at the front there with John Elliott and some other officials, and there was no inkling that John Guerrieri was about to announce his resignation. Of course, John Elliott copped a fair bit of flack at that meeting, with the Blues members not too happy about the loss of Aaron Hamill, of course, a well-known player in Canberra, and he copped a fair few questions from the floor on that, and maybe the Blues didn't want to cop any more flack by announcing the chief executive was about to resign as well. So maybe there was some sort of... It's unknown whether Guerrieri knew about his obvious decision, and I would have thought at that time, but it was quite interesting that it wasn't... There was no mention of it at that meeting. So, yes, it's troubled times there for the Blues. They've had quite a bit of turmoil off the field, which is very unusual for them. Normally a very, very stable administration, but there's been a fair bit of trouble with contractual problems and all sorts of a number of other things, and of course the other problem, as you alluded to in your introduction there, is that they've had a little bit of a setback with Anthony Koutafidis's knee not healing as well as one would hope. Of course, when he did his knee, I think in July this year, there was hope that he would get back for the finals. Well, he certainly wasn't back for the finals, and he's still got a lingering problem with it. So he says, and I heard him interviewed by John Elliott at the end, he said that he'll be right for round one, but he's certainly not training with the major group at the moment. He's doing his own training at the moment. But it's something that's certainly a bit of a worry for the Blues, and on top of the fact that Stephen Silvani's not started training yet in with the whole group. I think he's only doing light work, and Craig Bradley, of course, has just come reached an agreement with the club again, and he's only been training with the group very briefly. He was off training on his own, so things have not been going so smoothly at Optus Oval in the pre-season, shall we say.
And the other thing that a lot of people forget is that whilst there's been some changes in the board level and some changes on the field, there's also been one big change with Parko going back to Glenferrie, albeit not in a coaching role, but that it will be a big change, not having Parko overseeing the whole ensemble.
It will. Wayne Britton has been involved with the club for 5 years, and has really been basically the match day coach, and he's really been the coach for the last year. So there hasn't been, it won't be too much of a change. There's still the strong backup of the Stephen Kernaghan, John Worsfold, Barry Mitchell, Greg Williams team, which is a very, very strong off-field team to help Britton, and they will obviously assist Britton. But it really, the heat is on Britton. There's no doubt. He was quite impressive in his speech on Wednesday night. But the heat is on Britton, and I mean, having not played AFL footy, he's probably under more scrutiny than a David Parkin. He's got the runs on the board, 211 games, four-time premiership coach, all of these sorts of things, whereas Britton really has to prove himself, and certainly a fairly demanding lot, the Carlton lot. I don't think there's any question about that, particularly now that Essendon have drawn level on premierships with them at 16. They'll be hoping to draw ahead again with this current group, and, well, it's going to be a very, very big task for Wayne Britton.
Yeah, it is indeed. And, well, he and all of you at the Sunday Sun Herald, we appreciate the time that you take with us each week to have a chat, Howard, and also like to wish you and everyone there a very happy Christmas and a Merry New Year.
Good on you, Craig, and I wish everyone in Canberra the same thing, and I hope that everything goes well, and we'll be back next week reporting on the Boxing Day test and how well it went.
Shares? Yeah, we've got a few.
Great. So how are they doing?
Oh, well, I'm not into it that much. I mean, I wish I was, but, you know, it's a bit complicated and scary.
What if someone made it easy for you?
Easy to understand or easy to do?
Both. Shares Made Easy is a great interactive home learning pack which makes share trading and investing both easy to understand and easy to do.
Sounds okay. But is it easy on the pocket too?
Sure is. The Shares Made Easy pack, including a 2.5-hour video, a comprehensive manual and special software, gives you a wealth of information for only $195 delivered.